Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, shall we close our eyes and observe a moment of silence for prayer and meditation? We need God's guidance, because whatever we're doing, it is about God's people. Thank you. Thank you. Well, honorable members, good morning, and I would like to greet the delegation from the National Treasury, delegation from FFC, and also we have, I'm reliably informed that we have chairpersons of provincial finance committees, and greetings to you. I'd like to welcome all of you to this meeting. It is a meeting where we will be receiving a briefing from the National Treasury and FFC on the Division of Revenue 2017. As honorable members would know, transfers made through the Division of Revenue redistribute resources from areas of high economic activity, where most of the country's taxes are raised, to areas where public services are most or mostly needed. The majority of government revenue raised at national level is allocated to provinces and municipalities based on the relative demand for services rather than their ability to contribute revenue. We also note that to expand our social services package in a sustainable manner, create jobs and reduce poverty, South Africa needs much faster rates of inclusive economic growth. Indeed, we will need to all work together so as to address South Africa's economic and development challenges. Again, we thank you. Okay, we thank the National Treasury and the FFC Commission for their valued contributions to the work of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. I'm looking forward to a fruitful deliberations. But then I want us to adopt the approach that says this is our meeting, so that we can feel free and give our best input to this meeting, so that the two committees can achieve on their mandate. Thank you very much. You are all welcome. Now, item number two is apologies. The secretariat from both committees.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. We have no apologies from the Standing Committee on Appropriations.
Sir?
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. We do not also don't have any apologies also in the Select Committee on Appropriations.
Okay, thank you very much. Shall we then proceed to the next item, which is presentation by National Treasury? I will now call upon National Treasury to brief us, and Honourable Members, let's listen attentively and carefully, you know, so that we can then be able to engage, and in our engagement we remain relevant to the topic before us, or subject before us. Okay, over to you, Madam.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair, and Honourable Members of the Committee, and a very good morning this morning. My name is Madijeng Naleni. I am the Deputy Director General responsible for Intergovernmental Relations Division at the National Treasury. I am accompanied by Wendy Fanwe, who is the...
Let me check. Can you all hear her?
And Stephen Kenyon.
Okay. If you can bring your mic closer.
Okay. So Wendy Fanwe and Stephen Kenyon, who are accompanying me in this briefing. We will, both of us, take you through the presentation. this is the outline of what we are going to present to you this morning. I will first start by outlining, you know, the overview in terms of the contents of the bill and the processes that we went through to compile the bill. We will also give you a brief overview of the Division of Revenue for the 27 MTF. I will cover that. And then it will be followed by the responses to the recommendations on the Division of Revenue by the parliamentary committees and FFC. So we will respond to indicate how national government has taken those into consideration in the budget. So then we'll also outline the changes that have been introduced in the 2017 bill, as well as provincial and local government allocations. So in terms of outlining the contents of the bill, I think what is important is to always remember that the bill has got like three main parts. The first part is about the schedules of the bill. So this forms part of the bill that will be then enacted into an act. So the schedules is also the clauses of the bill. So the schedules run from 1 to 7 and 1 to 2 and 3 equitable divisions of revenue and the equitable division of revenue between the provinces. Schedule 2, Schedule 3 is the equitable division of share divisions between the municipalities. Then Schedule 4 is supplemental conditional grants to provinces. And municipalities is usually is 4A provinces and 4B municipalities. And then Schedule 5 is conditional grants, the specific of purpose allocations to both municipalities and provinces, with 5A being provinces and 5B being municipalities. And 6 is indirect grants, and 7 is a disaster allocation. So then you have got a next part, which is explanatory memorandum. That falls apart, falls away when we when the bill is enacted. And then the last part is conditions of the grants and the framework. These are gazetted to give effect to they are given effect by a gazette that will happen after the bill is enacted. So how do we process the bill, I mean, in terms of compiling the bill? The first thing that we want to highlight is how we determine the baseline allocations. So usually the starting point of the baseline on the allocations to the Division of Revenue Act is usually the consultations around, which happens very early in the year around August. September, where we issue the bill to all national departments, to province, to SARGA and FFC, for them to comment on the process of the bill in terms of what they would want to see change. So the baseline allocations are usually based on the indicative MTF allocation. So if you look at 2017 MTF, so this will be comprised of the two indicative 17-18 and 18-19 of 2016 MTF, and then the added year that is usually added by adding CPI to the third year allocations of 2016. So then on the basis of that, then the deliberations will discuss throughout the budget process on the changes that would be made to the baseline allocations. So how do we then consult? So I think what we are reflecting here is that the consultation process that leads to the tabling of this budget in February is quite extensive. It will always start at a technical level with technical processes of departments submitting their estimates to the National Treasury and the and our teams engaging with those proposals. Also, DPME is quite key in formulating or leading the formulation of government priorities that will then inform the allocations or the prioritization and the trade-off that will have to be made in the budget. Then we have got function groups. So if you look at the budget review, chapter 5, it will usually outline the allocations and the and the changes that were made by budget by function group. So where we the departments or the sectors that belong to the same function are put together, so that then we can begin to understand the kind of outcomes that they have to deliver and the kind of trade-off that needs to be made within that function and what are the priorities within that function. So after those deliberations and the proposals being made in terms of the prioritized policies and the prioritized reallocations and additions to allocations, then these are usually presented in terms of the intergovernmental consultations to the Technical Committee on Finance. So you must also remember the function groups also include intergovernmental groups where we bring provincial sector departments and provincial treasuries to engage on the sector. So all that will be presented in the Technical Committee of Finance and the Medium-Term Expenditure Committee that is made up of officials from DPSA, COPTA, and DPME, and National Treasury. They deliberate, therefore, on the proposals arising from the function group. These are taken to the Minister's Committee on the Budget that will make recommendations that will go to Cabinet, but those will be discussed also in the Budget Council and the Budget Forum in terms of how they also impact on the provinces and local government. And then those are recommendations are presented to the extended cabinet that will include the premiers of the 9 provinces. So the MPPS will usually include the proposals to the Division of Revenue that would bring about any substantial changes in the grants also. So we have tabled the MPPS in October, and the deliberations in the parliament have generated the reports that we are and recommendations that we are going to respond to. And the budget is tabled after the MINCOMBAT, and the whole process again has looked at any changes post-MTBS. So in terms of the allocations of the bill, so the bill will usually reflect the equitable share allocations, which will be determined through the formulas. So after we have determined the vertical split between the national, provincial, and local government, so in any share of each sphere in terms of provincial and local government is subjected to the formula. And those formulas are usually described in detail in an explanatory memorandum, that is W1, in the annexure of that goes along with the budget review. So the conditional grants also are reflected in the bill. And the total amount that allocated to these grants are usually determined throughout the budget process. So once the allocation for a grant has been determined, the national department therefore would have to take decisions in terms of how those grants are allocated and the grant framework that will determine the conditions and the outcomes and outputs that they are expected from that grant. So the transferring national officer will usually submit the conditional grants and allocations at the beginning of October. And this we also use to consult also with provinces. The transferring officer will then submit the final conditional grants frameworks and the allocations in December. So this will usually have to be signed off by the transferring officer. And we can only make changes if there are really major challenges that could undermine equity and stability in the allocation. But normally it will always be what the national department or the transferring officer has signed off on. So this is now the outcome of the whole process that we have outlined of how the divisions in the allocations were made. Between the three spheres of government and within sphere between equitable shares and conditional grants. So I think what is important here is to see that in spite of the constrained environment that we are in and the fiscal consolidation that we have been informed the budget allocations or the fiscal framework, we can see that the provincial and local government allocations are growing in real terms. So on average, 7.5% compared to about 7% at the national level, and the local government total allocations are growing by 8.6% on average over the MTF, which is quite significant given the times that we are in, and the whole idea is really to protect the basic services. So what happens then in the process of engagement with regard to this estimates and allocations, there has been some reductions that were made to the baseline to support fiscal consolidations and also to reprioritize to other key priorities. So how this affected provinces is that only 1.6 billion of the equitable share was cut from the province's baseline and 4 billion from the provincial conditional grants and 2.5 billion from the local government conditional. So these are the cuts from the baseline that we have mentioned. However, there were additions that were made that would at least ensure that even that what was cut was actually, its impact was actually minimized, and we could still see the growth that we see now in the allocations. So 7.3 billion has been added to the provincial equitable share, mainly to support education and health. And then for 5.1 billion has been added to local government equitable share in order to ensure that we can protect provision of free basic services. And even for conditional grants, there has been additional 390 million over the MTF for the National School Nutrition Program to ensure that, address the inflationary aspect of food. And 1 billion has been added to INEP for electrification for the poor. So we have already seen that on average the allocations are growing by 7.5% for provinces and 8.6%. So what we see here is that even though the allocations that we present on the main budget would usually exclude their own revenue that national, that provincial and local government would have, because the fiscal system does assign the differing revenue capacities to both local government and provincial government. So local government has been allocated major revenue raising capacities with the most of the services. So in addition to the property tax that they can impose and the surcharges that they can impose on the services, but they also deliver services that can be paid for. So if you compare that with provinces that deliver education and health that you normally don't derive any income out of, so they depend more on the transfers compared to local government that can raise revenue from selling the services and taxes. So when you look at the total fiscal framework now, taking into consideration the own revenue of provinces, which is about 4%, and the own revenue for municipalities, which is around 70% of their revenue, then you realize that the fiscal framework does allocate 25% to local government, and 36% to provinces, and 39% to national government. So in terms of the main changes to the structure of the allocations to provinces and local governments, so what we see is that you will hear about the formulas that are being used to allocate the provincial equitable share, and which we use this year, but we are reviewing it for the future. So we have introduced, there has been an introduction of new grants, the new early childhood development grant. So this grant was announced last year without any allocation, and I think the whole idea was to allow for planning, to give a planning, which is always a major challenge with the conditional grant. If you didn't plan it, the first year usually is planning. So we are hoping that there's a difference in this one because we did provide time for planning. So now from 17-18, there would be an allocation that will expand access and improve facilities for this early childhood development that under the for the children from 0 to 4 years old under the social development department. So we also have a grant that the Department of Social Development has introduced for hiring of social workers. So these sectors have been giving scholarships for the past 3 years to social workers, and it has been observed that the provinces have not been able to absorb those due to financial constraints. So what this small grant does is to enable them to hire those and to ensure that the department can be able to expand services while also, you know, improving on employment. The new grant also for education of and learners with intellectual disabilities. So we have also strengthened the incentives part of the health, education, and roads infrastructure grants in this case. So for local government, the current allocation will reflect the updates of data from 2016 community survey, and will also show that the RSC levy replacement grant that is given to the districts, we have been able to adjust the growth between the districts in order to address some of the challenges for the municipalities that have very low allocations over time. The budget eradication program is also provided for to be completed, but through the funding from the grants under the water department. What we are reflecting here is that the fiscal system is also a very powerful tool for the redistribution, because what we see here is that the Division of Revenue does achieve a substantial redistribution from the wealthy, mainly urban areas, to more rural areas where the demand for services are much higher relative to their capacity to raise revenue. So when you look at on the left, it reflects an average or per capita allocation per province. What you will see there is that a province like Northern Cape does receive much higher, you know, allocations per capita, you know, compared to all of them, which you could say the system of allocation also, you know, compensate them for the distance that they have to travel to provide services, even though they have got fewer people compared to other provinces. So a province like Gauteng, even though its allocations in actual fact grow very strongly, but per capita it is much lower, given that it is one province where relatively is the richer people that can afford to use private services like education and health compared to, for instance, in Free State and Eastern Cape. So, and then you look at this side with regard to rural municipalities, and what we are showing there is that the mostly rural municipalities, which in a way receive almost at 1% of the transfers, and yet they contribute almost 5% of the revenue. So per household allocation is almost more than twice what metros, for instance, are receiving in transfers, even though almost 70% of the revenue is coming from the metros. So I think what we are trying to reflect here is that there is a strong redistributive element in the fiscal system that acknowledges that in those areas where there is more poverty and more people that can afford services, you want to enable those municipalities or provinces to be able to provide those services. So in terms of financial management, we are also continuing to focus a lot on strengthening our efficiency and effectiveness in how we are utilizing the resources. So we still expect that provinces will ensure that they prioritize the key services, because some of the challenges that we face is that even though the fiscal system does redistribute strongly to poorer provinces, what we are not having control on is how they prioritize and how they utilize those services to ensure that they actually deliver services and they deliver them effectively and efficiently. So part of what we are expecting is that they must continue to improve efficiency and to reduce spending on non-core services. And provinces have made some progress in a number of areas. They are controlling the number of employees appointed, especially the administrative part of their staffing. And we have seen quite a strong control there, but we have seen them that they are protecting still health and education. And they are also reviewing and rationalizing the number of provincial entities, and I think we'll see more progress being made in 2017-18 after a lot of process in the review happening in the previous years. And we are also seeing a reduction in non-core spending on goods and services, with this year expecting further decline of 4.5%. After the past 2 years, we have been seeing major declines in those areas. And we have seen also improvement in own revenue collection. So with regard to municipalities, this is the one area where we have not seen a very strong response in terms of improving allocations from non-core and improving efficiency. So there's major effort, therefore, going forward to work with these municipalities to ensure that we can improve efficiency. And one of the major areas which we believe will change the game in terms of efficiency improvement in municipality are the few areas that we are going to be working on. The one area is about the introduction of M-Score, which after about 4 years work in conceptualizing and training and empowering the municipalities, this will start from 1 July, the implementation. We expect their budget to be M-Square compliant from 1 July. That's a major reform that will bring a whole lot of transparency in how we compile our budgets and report on our spending. So the improvement in supply chain management, the reforms that are being introduced through the Office of the Chief Procurement Officers will also impact municipalities. And we also will want to work with them on improving their own revenue. And this really is about how they also set their tariffs and how they manage the whole value chain from their setting their bills and collection processes. So we also will be focusing on improvements in how they manage their assets. We do expect that they must spend at least 8% on the value of their assets, maintenance, and we know that at the moment they are around 6%. So that progressive improvement is what we are pushing for, but also in terms of their practices on how they are managing their assets is something that we are focusing on in this MTF 2017-18.
Good morning. We'll do better for round robin going forward. I'll take you through the responses that Parliament made during the MTBPH process, specifically those that's relevant to provinces and municipalities. Every year also in the beginning of the year, proposals are made on the division of revenue that's been tabled that year. And some of the recommendations then get updated as the next budget process unfolds. So where these changes and things have been implemented, we list those as well. Stephen will be taking you through the FFC recommendations. During the MTBPS process, a recommendation was made that government needs to ensure that there's comprehensive cost containment measures introduced, but also very critically important that the cost containment does not adversely impact on service delivery, and therefore it is quite key to ensure that critical staff are still employed and not impacted by the cost containment measures. In terms of how allocations are impacted, when the allocations are determined, critical positions are excluded from any reductions to ensure that provinces and also national departments are sufficiently protected to fulfill those positions. Provinces have done quite sterling work and introduced a number of measures to ensure that key positions are filled in terms of health and education. But also quite key to mention, even if you look at health and education, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be any reductions because you can differentiate in those sectors between positions that's directly linked to service delivery and the others that's administrative. And even in those sectors, you could still have instances where the administration is a bit bloated and it needs reform. But provinces, all of them have got policies in place on how to manage their staff numbers downwards without adversely impacting on service delivery. Then another recommendation that was quite key and linked to the MTVS process had to do with unit cost containment in rural areas. And generally, services delivered such as water, it is generally the water sector or the water department that then prescribes the norms and standards that needs to be applicable in terms of that service. The OCPO has also got a role to play. For example, about 2 to 3 years ago, they prescribed what the cost of an ideal school is, so that that can be the new benchmark, which actually also is quite a good initiative, because sometimes when a school is built, for example, the costs are a bit bloated, and if you compare it against the guideline, you could see whether you're really getting value for money. But another important thing with regard to the unit cost, it's very important that municipalities differentiate in terms of the cost they charge to paying households, which can afford to pay for services, and ensuring that their tariffs are correctly structured, like Malijing has pointed out. But the municipalities also ensure that their free basic services allocation in the equitable share is appropriately used and targeted towards the poor as well, so that there's not a high burden placed on them to pay for services that they cannot afford. Then in the MTPVS, National Treasury pointed out to the committee that a new ECD grant will be established, and Malijing has already also pointed that out. The grant is aligned to the ECD policy, and National Treasury is working quite closely with the department also to assist them to ensure that the grant framework was correct and aligned to the policy per se. Then another recommendation is the timely payment of teachers and nurses. And again, there's two issues that we would like to raise. The committee is very correct to point it out. There is a central system that all national officials and provincial officials are paid for, and basically it's a press of the button, and most government officials either get paid on the 15th of a month or the end of the month. But what is quite key, and that is where some of the errors happen, is that provinces need to ensure that when a new staff member is employed, that they capture them automatically or immediately on the partial system. If a person resigns, that they immediately take them off the partial system. And, for example, if someone passes on as well, that also be immediately captured. And some provinces have made substantial progress. For example, the Western Cape has got a system that nearly works automatically. It's so fast. Where if the information that comes from the regions immediately goes back to head office, and it's basically captured within a few days. But some provinces take a bit of time, and that could be a cause why some of the nurses and the teachers are not paid on time. It's because of, the systems are not appropriately administered by those provincial departments. And that could be something that must be looked into. But it's not a systems issue per se. Then with regard to the in-year revision of conditional grants, there was the committee recommended that some of the allocations that were incorrect be fixed, and that has been done. Then with regard to the impact of the or the removal of the bucket eradication program grant, if you just look at it as per se, you would say, oh, that is a very, very bad thing that the bucket eradication program grant is now being incorporated into a number of other water sector grants. But it's actually a very good development, because what the bucket eradication program grant did is look at short-term immediate interventions, which is often not sustainable. And the advantage of actually dealing with it in a more holistic way is that more sustainable long-term solutions can be put that can actually be sustainable in the long term. And that is quite a key development. Then with regard to the recommendation on the monitoring of the spending on capital projects, that is definitely important and is definitely taking place as well. This on the right-hand side just provides a bit more information on how it's done. Then I would like to spend a bit of time on the Provincial Equitable Share Formula Review and the recommendation that's made that we do take into account the concerns raised by certain provinces. Maybe just to highlight that provinces, as well as the FFC, will be part and parcel of the review. They are actually part of and parcel of the review. And our intention is, and some work's already been done, so it's not that nothing has been done yet. What is quite important and how we will tackle the review is that it will be, for example, we'll focus for 2018, we'll look at three components that would be subjected to review, and it's the biggest component in the Provincial Equitable Share Formula. The first one would be the basic education component, the second one would be the health component, and then one that's very, very topical is, although we will not review the formula per se, but we'll do a lot of literature work, a lot of assessments what's happening in other countries, is the rural component, or how do you deal with rural versus urban in a formula to ensure that you treat both provinces with more rural areas fairly compared to provinces that's got large urban areas, because both have got their unique challenges, and you would make the formula inequitable if you just focus on the one component without focusing on the other component. So with regard to the sector reviews, we will be doing it in collaboration with a national department responsible for that sector, as well as the provincial treasuries, as well as the provincial sector departments as well, so that we can get a full and holistic view of the changes that's necessary. Another good thing that's happening that could also assist the review, and often what we've got a challenge, the formula can only be as good as the information that's available that you can use reliably, and you know what you're using is actually, you know, quite solid, and it's not unfair. The Department of Basic Education is currently in the process of changing the data collection system to make it much more robust, to get much more reliable information. And in the health as well, a lot of work has been done to also get updated information to feed into the formula. So what we would like to propose is that during the MTPPS, if National Treasury could be afforded an opportunity, and possibly it would be good to include other relevant stakeholders as well, to give feedback to the committee on the work that's been done by them, because it could be quite useful as a precursor or a pre-planning session to the 2018 budget. Then with regard to the reduction of allocations, it is targeted towards two areas, and the one is where grants grow quite fast, and the other areas where grants are actually where there's underspending, so it is not just a blanket cut. The next one regarding the local government equitable share is again is more about the use, and What is quite key there is that National Treasury works with the larger municipalities, the provincial treasuries work with the smaller municipalities, and what we have is what we call municipal benchmark exercises, which is then also monitored throughout the year to see whether their budgets are actually appropriately funded and caters for all the areas, and of how they use the equitable shares in part and parcel of that approach. Then if you look at, again, the review of the local government equitable share formula, some concerns were raised that, you know, when you're plotting the new community survey data, it could have a huge impact on municipalities whose population, for example, has diminished slightly. And generally what we do is we guarantee that a municipality will receive 90% of its allocation that it received previously. And what we've done to buffer the shock is to increase the 90% to 95% so that it gives them more leeway and more time. Then we also indicated in the MTPS that one of the changes that we're working towards is to take the electrification program grant that goes to metropolitan municipalities and consolidate it into the what we call the Urban Settlements Development Grant, or the USDG. But it's still work underway. It will not be done for the 2017 MTF, but work is underway to target to do it by the 2018 MTF. And what is quite key when you make any change to a conditional grant and you incorporate it, to ensure that, you know, it's done in a smooth way and the project that's done in the one grant is either transferred into the new grant or it's completed. So those are the type of issues that we need to look at. Then the next recommendation deals with post-demarcation review. There is work underway, but it's more under the stewardship of the Department of Cooperative Governance, who's responsible for that piece of legislation. Although National Treasury will be part and parcel of the process, we're not the lead department. And then the strengthening on the infrastructure incentives. We fully agree with what is proposed, and there's two ways that we provide support. The first one is we don't introduce an incentive without at least giving 3 to 5 years, or even more than that, for provinces and municipalities to get their house in order. But during implementation, we also see which ones didn't meet the incentives, and we provide specific support to them. Then on the cost containment measures, we've already touched on it quite in detail, and on the right-hand side, you just see quite a lot of examples of how it is done. Stephen, over to you.
Thank you, Wendy. I'm going to take you through FFC recommendations. So the FFC tabled their recommendations in May of 2016, and Section 9 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act stipulates that they must make those recommendations, and then Section 10 says that national government must reply in the explanatory memorandum and account for what changes we made to the Division of Revenue to incorporate the FFC recommendations. Those recommendations that the FFC made that are not related to the Division of Revenue have been referred to the individual departments and ministers that are responsible for the areas the recommendations were made on, and they've been requested to reply directly to the FFC on those recommendations. So with regards to the recommendations for 17-18, the FFC recommendations were focused on rural development. Government agrees on the importance of rural development, and as Marijeng has outlined, the Division of Revenue achieves a substantial redistribution of resources raised from largely urban tax base and spent predominantly on rural services. So the Division of Revenue is, as the FFC rightly identified, a powerful tool for redistribution and promoting rural development. Government policy, though, also emphasizes, and you'll see this even in the Integrated Urban Development Framework, the interconnectedness between rural areas and urban areas, that it is one country, that people move between urban and rural areas, families move between urban and rural areas, income and economic activity also move. And so we need to develop in a holistic way that supports both urban and rural development. In terms of the specific recommendations that the FFC made with respect to aspects of the division of revenue, we've agreed with most of the FFC recommendations. Some of the changes that they've recommended have already been implemented in this year's Division of Revenue Bill. For example, the greater emphasis on performance in grants, and you'll see that in the provincial slides that Wendy will present next, as well as the increased weighting given to the Agriculture Policy Action Plan within the CASP grant. And then there are also several recommendations that we support in principle, but that there are still works in progress in terms of implementing. So, for example, the improved monitoring and evaluation that they've recommended, the moves towards further grant consolidation, as well as the use of improved cost estimates in our allocations. There are also some areas where government differs on the content or the implementation of some of the recommendations, and I just want to take you through those briefly. So while government agrees on the need to structure infrastructure incentives to promote economic growth, we don't feel that it's always appropriate to do this in all of the conditional grants, because most of the conditional grants fund the social infrastructure, and economic considerations aren't the main reason you'd decide on where a clinic should be located, for example. So we disagree slightly on the emphasis to be placed there. Then government agrees on the need for improved alignment of support for rural development. This referred particularly to programs in the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. And there is work underway between those two departments with the Treasury to better align their programs, but we think it's premature to recommend a shift of funds from the one department to the other at this stage. So we have a difference with the FFC there, again, around the timing and implementation of that, but not a disagreement on the principle of improved coordination. They also recommended that they recommended very specifically that the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation undertake a review of provincial infrastructure grants. And the DPME methodology for those performance and expenditure reviews requires another department to co-fund the review, and we weren't able to secure a co-funder for the review in this year, and so the DPME, though, is keen on that review, so they will try, they will keep it on the list of potential projects and try to find a co-funder for that. So that wasn't possible to implement. The EPWP, they recommended that every participant receive training. In the original EPWP Phase 1, that was a requirement, and the Department of Public Works, in their review of that phase, found that most of the training that was provided under that circumstances was compliance-driven and wasn't really valuable, didn't transform the capabilities of the people receiving training. And so Phase 3 places an emphasis on targeted training and also on business development training. Then also, the FFC recommended that households affected by farm evictions should be assisted through disaster grants. From the Treasury's side, from government's side rather, we don't believe that farm evictions fall under the classification of a disaster. Also, funding is already provided for in the Human Settlements Development Grant for eviction-related matters, and all provinces are required to plan in their HSDG business plans to make provision for eviction-related needs. And then lastly, with regards to the costing model that FFC and SALGA developed for local government, equitable share allocations, cost of basic services, there's some great work that's in that model, and the FFC have implied that we should make more use of it. We believe it's a powerful tool for analysis, but some of the assumptions that are made about the levels of service in the grant mean that if their costing model was to be implemented wholesale in our formula, some of the assumptions assume that urban services are more expensive, and that would result in larger allocations to urban areas, which would undermine a lot of that redistribution picture that Marijeng was highlighting earlier in the presentation. I'm now going to take you through the two slides on the Division of Revenue Bill clauses. Most of the clauses in the Division of Revenue Bill remain the same from year to year. The major change on a policy level this year is on the regulation of in-year conversions between direct and indirect allocations. So indirect allocations are Schedule 6 allocations in the Division of Revenue Bill, and they're created in order to allow a national department to do work on behalf of a province or municipality, typically where the province or municipality doesn't have the capacity to spend for themselves. So that's the purpose of the indirect grants. And Section 21 of the bill allows for the conversion within the financial year from between direct and indirect allocations. So we've changed Clause 21.1 to make it easier for for funds allocated as an indirect grant to be converted to a direct grant. This typically allows provinces to speed up the implementation of a project that may have been planned for the National Department at the beginning of the year. Then Clause 21.2 clarifies the criteria for the in-year conversion of a direct allocation to an indirect. So this is a situation where, say, direct funds were allocated to a municipality and they're not able to implement a project, and now we want to convert, a department wants to convert the allocation to an indirect allocation so that the national department can implement it. And we've clarified that national departments must demonstrate, A, that they have the capacity to do the work, that the province or municipality has a history of underperformance, that there's been a genuine effort to improve the capacity of that province or municipality. It mustn't be that the first response is to try and take away the funds. And then also they must demonstrate that it will prevent under expenditure and improve delivery.
If I may interject, sorry. We are running out of time. At exactly 5:30, we had planned to engage in engage with this presentation. So if you can just round up, but focus on those key issues that you think are important for the meeting, and then we move on to deliberations.
I will go very quickly through the rest of this. So that covers the conversions between allocations. The other changes to the clauses are largely technical, and they're summarized on this slide. I don't think they're, in the interest of time, they're worth going through. So I'll give back to Wendy to go through the provincial allocation.
Thanks. I'll be quite quick because Malijeng's presentation has already captured most of the issues. So in the next slide, it already indicates what Malijeng has presented. And also the next slide indicates the three new grants that's introduced, which Malijeng has already taken you through. The detail of how those grants work is just provided in a bit more detail. Then with regard to the next slide, it deals with transport. For a number of years now, basic education or the infrastructure grants related to education, as well as the infrastructure grants related to health, has had incentive components. It's now been extended to the transport sector as well. And what is quite important is that it's based on credible information on what needs to be done to ensure that strategic provincial roads are actually brought back to where they're supposed to be in terms of being roadworthy and support them better transport. What the next slide does is just indicating how the current formula works and then indicates on the top row the weightings allocated to each component, which is similar and it has been similar for the last 2 years. As part of the review, we'll also look at the weightings to see whether it needs any changes. What the next, Stephen, you're a bit difficult. What the next one shows is the information that's used in the provincial equitable share formula, and each and every data set that's used is actually contained in Annexure W1 of the which is part of the Division of Revenue Bill. So provinces should just look at what informs that as well. What the next slide then shows is after the formula has been implemented, what happens to the shares. And given that the provincial equitable share formula is run every year, we don't want to have a situation where the new data updates then result in huge shocks to both provinces that's gaining but also provinces that's losing, because if you get too much too soon, you won't be able to spend it. Even if you could spend it, you won't be spending it necessarily appropriately. So what the next slide does is just to show how the phasing is done. And then what the next slide does is then just to explain, you know, with regard to the data updates, you know, who's the biggest gainers in terms of each component. And as you can see, it varies per component, it just shows more detail as well. And in the bottom line, it shows then the overall change compared to the previous financial year. And then the next slide is just a summary of of the provincial conditional grants. Thanks.
I can very quickly take you through the local government side. 2 minutes. Thank you, Chair. I have to begin with an apology, a very sincere apology from the National Treasury side, that there is an error in the codes of the municipalities in the bill. And we would like to really apologize to you and to the committee. This is not obviously how we like things to be done. In the schedules and in the annexures and appendices to the bill, there was a technical error that crept in the final stage of the bill preparation, where the zeros were dropped from the municipal codes. So, for example, a municipal code that should be EC101 is reflected as EC11. And you'll see it in Schedule 3 of the bill. All the municipal names are correct, all the places are the same, and all of the allocations in the bill are correct. So it's just the codes that have an error, but we would like to, again, apologize for it, and then also request that the committees recommend that error, that technical error, be corrected in the enacted version of the schedules, and we will make the correction in the gazetted version of the allocation. And to take you quickly through the transfers to local government, I'm not going to go through this slide. It summarizes the transfers. On the equitable share, we'd like to emphasize that the household subsidy for municipalities is 359 rand per month per household. That's the updated costed figure. And there's also the institutional and community services fund to support poorer municipalities. On the cost of services, all the costs have been updated, and in fact the cost of electricity has been costed at the 8% increase in MYPD3. Just after the budget was tabled, NERSA announced that actually the bulk tariff is 2.2% increase, and so municipalities have been informed through the MFMA circular that if that is the final bulk tariff that is tabled by the Minister of Public Enterprises, then there will be some kind of overfunding in this year, and that will be offset in the calculation of next year's subsidies. So they need to budget appropriately on that. We've also updated the household numbers with the community survey data, as we discussed with the recommendations the committee's recommendations earlier. We've been very careful to make sure that the impact of these changes, where there is slower household growth, is cushioned through a 3-year phase-in, as well as a 95% guarantee. So every municipality receives at least 95% of the funds that we promised in last year's budget. We also are adjusting the allocations to district municipalities. 4.8 billion rand is transferred to districts through the RSC levies replacement grant, but this replaces and mirrors the collection of an old tax instrument that obviously mirrored the inequitable pattern of distribution of that tax system. So poor rural municipalities have very low allocations on this. Working with provincial treasuries and SALGA, identified the 13 worst-off districts in this regard with the lowest allocations, and we have increased their allocations, and to pay for that, we've taken the 10 districts with the largest allocation, and we've reduced their growth rate. So the allocations still grow, but by a lower amount, and the money that's freed up has been used to redistribute to those 10 poorest districts, which again reinforces that idea of redistribution that we talked about at the beginning of the presentation. And the last one I think we've covered already under the recommendations. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you so much for the elaborate and insightful presentation by National Treasury. Before we proceed with the business of the meeting, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome Ms. Vivian Mentor-Lalu from Dula Omar Institute, attached to the University of Western Cape. Together I'm going to ask them to rise at the end, eh? With her is Professor Ho, who is with 10 students from the Rutgers University, New Jersey, in the United States of America. I'd like to ask you to rise so that the meeting can see you. Thank you very much, and thank you for showing interest in our work. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the deliberations. Okay. Honorable members, we will now move on to deliberations or interrogation of the presentation. Honorable Member DBS, number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, six, seven, eight. Please remember your number in that order. But then I'll appreciate that in your intervention, you become short and to the point, so that we can manage our time well. Oh, number 10. Yeah, number 10. Number 9. You're number 9, am I right? Yes. So she's number 10. And you are number 11. All right. In that order, Honorable Member DPR, you may start.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Listening to the speed that we are working at, I will propose in future that we start at 8 o'clock in the morning. Teachers are starting at 7:30 in my province, so we can start at 8 and have some 30 minutes additional for engagements.
Thank you.
Chair, I want to go back to the presentation of 26th of February 2016, slide 44. And Mr. Kenyon knows my question, because it will be the third time I'm going to ask the same question. Why? Because the previous reply was, this is work in progress. So we want to establish where is the progress today. The question I'm putting here, where is it captured in your presentation referring to ECD infrastructure? I'm reading. Government is exploring options on how to fund ECD infrastructure. However, the functional issues around the responsibility of ECD infrastructure, in brackets between NPOs, municipalities, and provinces, remain very complex. Where are we today? What is the progress on this? Because this is crucial when we do our oversight outside. Then, Chair, to the team sitting here, a word of thanks for the intervention regarding the drought relief funds being released to my province, Northern Cape. There were obstacles. It's one thing to come and sit in a meeting and put the documents on the table. It's something else when it must be implemented outside. And farmers are waiting since November, October, when the MTPBS was tabled. And we approved the funding in October. And this intervention took, since January, up till about 3 weeks ago, to be rolled out. And that's the point, Chair, the way we do our oversight. That's important. It's not about just asking questions. It's going deeper into things. Let it happen at grassroots level. Chairperson, the question on slide 11 in the presentation, referring to the bucket system, etc., falling under water and sanitation. Completion of the bucket eradication program will be funded through bulk, and so it goes on. This department underspent. It was funding by the Auditor General. Seeing that this is now transferred to that department, the implication is we must do our oversight better, that these funds are rolled out and get to where it must get. This is a very, very serious point. The bloating cost of building schools. I take you back to 2011, 2012, 13, 14, the intervention in the province of Limpopo. There it came out how the cost was bloated and what it actually cost to build a school. Excuse me. That research that was done then, can we get some clarity on that to inform us now? I dealt with this, the ECD issue, the PEC review, very important, reliable and credible information. Slide 23, the local government equitable share. This process, when will it be finalized, also referring to district municipalities, there's a study going on there. When we visit our province, that's a question we get. Can you give us clarity on that? I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
But also for control purposes, thank you very much. May we have each member asking at least 3 questions. And then, time allowing, you will be given a second bite. Thank you very much.
All right.
Number 2.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would want to stick to your ruling. Chair, I wish to draw your attention to slide 8. And it's a matter that I might want to come back to in October once the MTBPS has been tabled this year. And I'm raising it as a concern that given the assumption that metros are better equipped to actually collect own revenue, and I'm talking to the general levy sharing with metros issue, and given the fact that, and that assumption, and the weaknesses of the tax basis of smaller municipalities, I would want us to have a discussion going forward. It may not necessarily be in this particular meeting, but a concern has been raised in the past, and we'll continue to raise this concern in relevant platforms. And then the issue relating to the ECD on slide 11, Chair, we much as we appreciate the fact that 1.3 billion rand has been allocated in the MTF cycle and is being reinvested, our problem is that how does it feed into basic education as well as health? We appreciate that the funding is ring-fenced in social development, but our problem is the interface in terms of this very function, the interface between social development, the Department of Education, as well as the Department of Health, which together needs to be dealing with this particular matter. What experience is on the ground is such that there is a silo mentality going on there, and therefore fragmentation insofar as that particular function is concerned. And it is an important function where we are seated to ensure that we develop our children in this particular country. So I would love to see some integration with regards to that specific grant and that interface between the 3 departments that I've referred to. And then lastly, Chair, on education, it's also on slide 11, I think. I appreciate the fact that there is now this special grant for learners with intellectual disabilities. Does it not undermine the policy and principle relating to inclusive education in the country? Are we not now creating yet another discriminating indirectly tool to these learners and saying to schools, do not have inclusive education at that level? And I'm talking really to my own personal experience during the school reopening process or monitoring process, where you would find that psychologists, social workers allocated to schools are not even known by those particular schools, and it undermines, in my view, the whole concept of inclusive education. But I do appreciate that funding is specifically made for those learners with these intellectual disabilities. Thank you, Chair.
Number three.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and keep it as short as possible. Just if I start with slide 11, and I see there, for example, provincial, we're going to give these two new development grants here. One to expand access and improve facilities by employing additional social workers, a new grant to fund the education of learners with intellectual disabilities. There's more examples of this throughout the presentation. All of these speak to employing more people. In other words, we're going to be adding more pressure to the national wage bill, which is really under supreme pressure. How do we justify this? Obviously, we have to increase the level of services that we offer to people, but we can't do that just by forever employing more and more people and adding to the national wage bill. It's not sustainable. And for every rand we spend on compensation of an employee, we're taking the rand away from the ultimate service that people get. You know, we only have so much money and it has to be spread out. On slide 13, you say reducing non-core goods and services and transfers. This is what picked my eye up. Expected to decline by 4.5% over the MTF. Then I looked at the top of this particular slide and it says, in order to prioritize available funds for service delivery, provinces and municipalities must continue to improve efficiency. Now we're saying, for this budget to work, you must do certain things. We're saying to municipalities, you must do this and the provinces must do that. What if they don't? Do we factor that in? Because in my experience, it just doesn't happen. They've got their own priorities. They've got their own things to do. And we're saying that this is only going to work if they must do something or they are expected to decline. On what basis are they expected to decline by 4.5%? How do we arrive at that kind of expectation? Again, you say improve revenue management. Municipalities need to set and collect cost-effective tariffs. But you have to do that against huge resistance from the public because it's the public, after all, who are paying these things. And you can't just go ahead and set your tariffs at whatever point you like because your citizens come and complain and they say we can't afford it. Under the current economic conditions, we just cannot do it. I have the same sort of comment when it comes to improved asset management. It's long been the mantra that we must spend 8% of our budgets on maintenance. But in a practical sense, it does not happen in municipalities because they just don't have the money. The available funds get spent. And they don't get spent on maintenance because there's always something else to take its place. It's the same as you'll always see in a budget or the budget of a municipality, there'll be a nice big amount for depreciation. That money's never there. That's just used to balance the books with. It's a fiction. And it's the same sort of thing here. They'll put an 8% maintenance figure in budget line, but the money's never used for maintenance because it gets swallowed up everywhere else. You know, it's a nice thing to say, but it doesn't happen with all due respect. I'll have one more, ma'am, if I may.
I hope that's the... Are you sure it's not the fourth one?
No, I think it's number three.
Third one, okay.
Am I wrong?
No.
Number three. I just wanted to... This is a quick question, and it's on slide 18, it is. On the personal system, I just wanted to know, is part of that system, is there an automatic PAYE deduction that goes directly to SARS? Is it part of the system... Or does that have to be arranged separately by each user of the personal system? Or is it factored into the system itself? Thank you.
And number four.
Thank you, Chair. Can I start from the 11 and come down? Or?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Let me thank Treasury for the presentation. One of the issues that I have is in terms of you talking about a saving of 25 billion rand because of the procurement processes you're putting. Now, I'm confused because your chief procurement officer said to us, and we've discussed this before, that we are spending at least 40% of the 600 billion rand a year that is being wasted as a result of not getting value for money. And you see, keep talking about 25 billion. I heard the other day the minister also mentioned 25 billion. Now, for me, there's a vast difference between that. And when he says 40%, he's talking about that we have no control over local government and provincial governments when in terms of the procurement process and supply chain and what they're paying, whether a product in KwaZulu-Natal will cost you 10 cents and in the Western Cape it will cost you 10 rand and that kind of thing. Are you putting some process in place at the moment, or when would you be able to do that? So there's some standard pricing throughout the country in terms of that. Now, I know sometimes we're going to say that certain items, you know, because of transport and this, but I'm saying generally, are you putting something in place so that we can start implementing this? And I want to agree with your chief procurement. He talks about, I estimated about 200 billion rand is lost in this country. He's going to 240 billion rand. So I want to know whether you think and when can we have something of that sort. Is the issue of this transport matter resolved now in terms of whether it falls on the transport, whether it falls on the basic education? Because this thing seems to be coming to us every year and then there's really no solution. From what I can actually see in terms of them. Now, you know, I think my colleague has spoken about the bucket system. Now, I think you know what the performance has been of the Department of Water and Sanitation. Now, I want you to justify whether you think that is, whilst you're supporting that, whether you can justify whether it is going to work in the interest of trying to eradicate that system. Now, in your view, and I think the question I'm asking now is, might be very unfair to you, but I think it will help us if you can give us an idea. You do know that we allocate these funds to provincial governments. It's there. They come with so-called plans, but a lot of that is not implemented. We have a problem. We have fiscal dumping in the last quarter. We have a whole lot of things. Do you believe that if greater responsibilities are given to the districts, in terms of taken certain from the provinces and given to the districts so they have smaller areas to manage, smaller numbers to manage, do you think we can have more effective service delivery on the ground in terms of that? Chair, I've got a few more. Must I go on and just finish it? Oh, can I stop there? Okay, I'll just go to the last one. In terms of this conversion of grants, because now you're going to agree with me that in more often than not, we're converting these grants because people are not performing. Now, rather than dealing with the problem on hand, we are trying to change the grants, and we got this grant and that grant and that grant. There's about half a dozen grants. Why are we not willing to deal with the culprits that year in and year out are failing our people but continue to be paid? I'll stop there for now, Chair.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Honourable Member.
Thanks, Chair, and I promise I don't have 11. It still holds the record. For me as well, Chair, on the ECD one, and it's sort of the same as that member that have raised it, for me, I would raise the argument that that function should initially be under education and not under social development, because I believe that social development don't do the function justice. That is just my argument. So I firmly believe it should move to education, and they should do that as primary as their task. And then under the one, the grant of giving a grant to students with intellectual disabilities, that one I'm totally happy about. I think it's long overdue that that aspect should have been looked into. So I'm happy that they are getting that sort of grant to sort of help those students and learners. As well with the social development one as well, Chair, because we knew what happened in Nelson Mandela, where all of those social workers were trained, over 400 in the Eastern Cape, and they were not placed in jobs and stuff. So for that one, I'm also sort of happy about that we are putting those grants in. But we should also look in terms of, as government, when we do this training, that the job is already there, then to create 2 years afterwards, while those students were trained, and they had to wait 2 years for a grant or
to be established in order for them to get employment. To sort of, when we say we are going to train artisans, that they will be guaranteed they will walk into Petra SA with a job secured. And then the last two ones, Chair, whether, because we had water and sanitation here last week. We were in a joint sitting with social development with SCOPA also the other day. And both of these departments sort of alluded to the one on social development with the crisis that we're having now with the social development grants and that saga of the CPS. And the minister alluded that they will not be given extra money for that particular challenges that they have found it in that particular aspect. So what is your views surrounding it, that one? And then also in the bucket eradication program, on the underspending, I don't know why are these, and I feel the same strongly as my colleagues. There seems to be no consequence. We just give these grants and they are there, and people don't spend it. Why they don't spend it, I don't know, because on a daily basis we go to our constituencies and a woman still have to walk 5 kilometers or maybe 5 kilometers is maybe too long, say 200 meters to a toilet, and in that process you get raped and all of those things. That still happens in South Africa. And you get to a point that where a certain government give a grant for a certain program and that money doesn't get spent and it's just business as usual. We need to find a way as to stop this and then hold these officials accountable to say, why haven't you spent that money? Because I think it's illegal. It's unlawful.
Honourable Member, may you round
done.
Up?
Chair, that's round why I up. Said these meetings mustn't be held on a Friday.
Not on a Friday. There was a very progressive proposal that we start the meetings at 7:30. So we will then have to resolve on that one. Thank you very much.
No, I'm done, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much. Number six.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be economical.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much for Treasury for presenting such an important presentation. We can see improvements, especially on page number 12, slide number 12, you know, on the allocation according to the poor provinces. But my question is based on slide number 13, a convention between direct and indirect grant. When the history taught us that the national departments have been underspending in the indirect grant and the provinces were better than the local government and the provinces were better than the national department in regard to spending on indirect grant. But now this section 21.1, I think, to say that it is a direct to indirect grant. Does it reverse to go to indirect to direct grant? Because it's like the national will only take from the lower sphere of government if they are not performing, but if the national department is not performing, the lower sphere can't take from them, because also we have seen that they have underspent around the issue of indirect grant. Yeah, that's what I want to clarify, because you only point on the lower sphere of government and don't look at the national department. I know that you have tried to put conditions to say that they have demonstrated and so on and so forth, but I don't think it's fair, because it's both sides. It's not one way. It's two ways. Secondly, Chair, it's around the issue of the transport. I think it's slide number 35, the incentives that you are talking about, that we are going to give to a province, provided when they show improvement on the road construction and so on. on that one. Do you give them? Do they spend their own budget? And then you give them incentives, or you give them budget and see on the budget that you have given, maybe specifically around the incentive grant, and then you give. Do they apply for it so that they can get it after they see that they have done it, or automatically you'll identify like competition sort of, and then you give. Lastly, Chair, it's around the issue of rural development. I was trying to page the slide here that you said it's critical rural development. This is my last question. Rural development. According to Treasury, how do you define rural development? Rural development. I'm asking this because where I come from in deep rural areas in KwaZulu-Natal, when they talk about rural development, it's like the companies coming to open the mall in our areas. When they open these malls, the local people are not part. They don't have ownership. They just say, we create these temporary jobs that will go. This is what they call a rural development. Does it have the element where the small business in those localities become part of those business and have ownership? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think the issue is also who is responsible to give a clear definition. Is it the National Treasury, or so that that person can be, or that department can be addressed so that we close this chapter on the definition of rural? All right. Thank you very much. Number 7.
That's me, Honorable Chair. Thank you. I'll be efficient and economical.
I'll be happy.
Slide number 11 talks about the reviewing of the provincial equitable share. Now, I would like to know, would the local government equitable share also be reviewed, because we know that there's a major problem there, that local government does not get enough money. Also on that slide, they mentioned a new grant to fund education of learners with intellectual disabilities. Are there teachers available to perform that function? So no. On slide number 25, this is an issue that I have a concern about. We had the Chief Procurement Officer, Mr. Brown, who came and did a presentation for us, and even Honorable Shope Sithole got excited about what he's planning to do. He halved the quotation and the price of building schools. Now, I believe that when he also spoke about eliminating corruption. I believe that he actually spoke himself out of a job, because as we know now, that he's no longer the Chief Procurement Officer. So he is going to be replaced, and I'm concerned that he might be replaced by somebody who is more corrupt, or corrupt rather than somebody like Mr. Brown. So I don't believe that that savings of 25 billion is going to materialize.
Honourable Member, in all fairness,
no, Chief, no.
We need to continue trusting National Treasury with their responsibility. So far, they haven't disappointed us.
No, Treasury.
Remember, they are the ones who are busy with the appointments, and we believe that they will appoint the same person like Mr. Brown. So can we please proceed?
Chair, I have to defend that. I don't believe that somebody as Mr. Brown, honest, will be appointed. Let's wait and see. On slide number 43, you talk about municipalities, the poorer ones that receive more because of them being unable to collect the amounts that are due to them. Can I ask then, that larger transfers per household, do they make up for that shortfall that the poorer municipalities or the poorer households fall short of? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And thank you very much, Treasury, for the presentation. I think some of my points have already been touched on, but I do want to touch on what my colleague has just mentioned with regard to local government. I'm always, I really have a soft spot for local governments all the time because I believe that local government isn't being allocated an adequate budget. It's just my observation, but the issue that I just would like to speak to is the fact that when you look at the division of revenue, local government is seen to be receiving a higher percentage of increase over the MTF, but the amounts are what I'm actually referred to. In the same breath, the local government own revenue issue. We have a serious problem with those, especially with the district municipalities who just don't have the capacity. They don't have the capacity, and of course, we have heard that those that can raise more revenue will, of course, subsidize the poorer municipalities. But the reality is that they are the strugglers in this whole thing. The other thing is the issue of capital projects. And I saw somewhere there where it speaks to the budget and the past underperformance. One may ask, who is actually underperforming? Is it the poorer areas? Is it, who is it? And I know for a fact that infrastructure projects, we have a lot of challenges around them. They are incomplete in many instances, and people are struggling. You know, we have all sorts of reasons. Sometimes the municipalities, some come to my mind, where municipalities start a project, then they get stuck along the way because they're still waiting for national treasure. But maybe if you can just briefly speak to that. And then the last one is the rural development. I think one of my colleagues has spoken to the issue of rural development, which is a very, very key area. Again, this is where I believe that we need to have a specific focus on, because people in the rural areas are just struggling. We can talk about all these things, but they don't even have the most basic services, which are better, are worse off than anyone else. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Honorable Member. Maybe just to top up your question on the revenue collection, if National Treasury can tell us what are they doing to capacitate municipalities on revenue collection. All right, number 9. Yes.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Oh, yes.
Let me join those who have appreciated the presentation. I only have got two issues to raise and one question. I think at slide number 12, I join those who are appreciating that grant for the hiring of social workers, because surely these social workers, which includes the CDWs, are playing a very important role in assisting government to fight poverty and to foster development. If that grant is allocated for those workers, it is mostly appreciated. Secondly, I think on slide 12 again, I think we must appreciate the allocation to rural municipalities, the double allocation to rural municipalities rather than the metros, because the rural municipalities are at the core phase of service delivery. So if you give them more allocation, it would assist with speeding up a service delivery to our people. The third question, Honorable Chair, I have not heard anything in terms of the rolling of the National Health Insurance. Is the a provision within this bill for the rolling of the national health insurance, because it's very important for the development of our people. And lastly, I appreciate that there are measures that will be put in place to ensure that municipalities are assisted in terms of their revenue collection and management, because even the AG, that is the matter that they are raising in the AG report, that most of our municipalities are not doing well in terms of revenue collection, management, and also the issue of maintenance. I think it should, in fact, be emphasized. That was the last but one question. And lastly, on slide 28, this is the third one.
Oh, okay.
This is the third one. The one that I'm, in fact, it's a question and comment, this last one, on the expanded public works program, that they will provide targeted training to get more clarity on that targeted training, because what used to happen with regards to the expanded public works program, they will provide training only for that project, and after that project, the people get employed. But if the targeted training would mean sustainable training, sustainable skills imparting, it would assist our people to be able to market themselves, even if that project has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to say to Treasury that I agree with them on their content. That is page 28. I fully agree with them. And secondly, my friend Dr. Fick, I just want to comfort you that 2017 is the first budget that no one will do anything untoward, because as this committee we have agreed to be on top of our game. Because I believe that all government departments are working, but I don't think ourselves as members of parliament are up to the game. So if we can just change our strategy a little bit and be hands-on, I don't think anybody can steal anything from government. We must not believe in people. We must go and check. We must stop this coming year and having nice tea. We must go and hold our meetings in Khayelitsha. Thank you very much.
Of course, the relevance of this input is that one of our core business is public participation. So the underlying message is let's strengthen our public participation, because we do public participation, but it needs to be strengthened. That's the underlying message. Come again. What's the difference in oversight being done in the community out there? Is that not linked to public participation? It is. All right, thank you very much. Thank you. Number 11.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Madam Chairperson. I'm Adriana Randall. I'm from the Gauteng Provincial Government. And I wanted to know, in terms of your per capita allocations, I'm sure you're aware of the massive urbanization rapidly and the in-migration into our province in terms of people seeing an opportunity as we are the so-called economic hub of this country. And I want to know, how did you determine the status of those migrating into Gauteng in terms of you're making use of private services or not? It's obviously putting a huge challenge for us as a province to deliver. And then secondly, in terms of local government, you know that equitable share is becoming a problem. If you look at our mega cities, let's use Savannah City, close to Midvale, that's being developed. You see a large component of FLISP housing, a large component of RDP. While FLISP is not attracting, RDP is, so Midvale Municipality cannot cope anymore with the equitable share. They now have to already, there's 800 new RDP houses built. They need to deliver in terms of bins, in terms of parks, whatever. Chair, and then also equitable share. Our smaller municipalities are now using that to honor payments on their ESCOM plans. Guys, this is not acceptable. We need to get the money to the poorest of the poor. And that's a challenge for us as well. And then growing debtors. I heard a few speakers talking about municipalities and revenue collection. I was shocked to see the 90 days and older debtors in our municipalities in Gauteng. If you take Tshwane, if you take Johannesburg, it's so alarming, and we are not getting it right. What do we do to enhance revenue collection, especially in terms of our 90 days and older debtors? Thank you so much.
No, mine is just a clarity-seeking question. I think it's slide 33 and slide 35, the incentive for the road maintenance. Our roads are not getting any better at provincial level, especially our rural roads. Do you think that works? Isn't it better to have a grant for the roads that is properly monitored, because there's no progress on our roads? So can you just give me feedback on that? Thank you.
All right. With your permission, I know I'm supposed to drive this, but I have a question to ask. I must commend National Treasury for implementing the Standing Committee on Appropriations recommendations during the medium-term budget policy statement. However, on slide number 20, under SCOA recommendations on 2016 Division of Revenue Bill, there's a contradiction, but you must correct me if maybe there's a misunderstanding from my side. You are saying here the reductions on bucket eradication program grants were meant to realign the budget to the actual costs of projects and will not have an impact on the projects themselves. That's your reduction. But in your next line, you say, in some instances, there have been delays due to changes in the scope of work, so which means there was a scope of work that was done. That's my understanding. Or technical challenges, and this resulted in funds being reprioritized to other projects where they can be spent. Now, to me, if there was a scope of work done, there should have been sensitivity on the service delivery, because there's work that has already been done, meaning that where you decided to reduce the budget, it could be that they were at an implementation stage. So now by reducing the budget, you then stopped that. It could be that I'm misunderstanding you, but indeed you need to explain that, because we want you to be sensitive. We are about service delivery. And also, I think the relevant department also should have applied and motivated why the grant should have the bucket program, bucket eradication program budget should be rolled over. They should have applied and even go to an extent of doing a presentation to National Treasury. Because indeed, this one, we really want it attended to. And it's long that we've been talking about eradication of bucket systems. So I think there should have been sensitivity. From where I am, I think there was insensitivity. So what is it that can be done to assist now with this program so that it can move forward? All right. And then on, I think it's just on 21. All right. I know that we made a recommendation that you should monitor the spending on capital projects. And actually what we were talking about, closely monitor, so that indeed in terms of the project plans, the budget is, you know, is used as planned, and then where there are hiccups, you pick them up on time and advise on how, on a turnaround, just on that challenge. But then you then respond by saying that the department provides extensive support for grant design and monitoring. You see, if you were providing one, we were not going to say, can you closely monitor? Now, it's like you were just responding for the sake of giving us a feedback. It's not convincing. What monitoring model do you have in place that can assist us to overcome the project, the problem we have in the spending on capital projects? Because when we said closely monitor, it's because we identified a problem. So we wanted to get around that problem, and then we said closely monitor. But then you say you are extensively monitoring. It's not convincing. Can you give us your monitoring model that you'll be using moving forward? I think that's all from me. Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you very much. We will now hand over to National Treasury to provide responses to all the issues that were raised. But also to National Treasury, if you could be short and to the point in your responses. We are running out of time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We will all of us respond. Honor of the BS, the funding for infrastructure for ECD, that is what we are trying to do now in terms of social development from the age which accommodates children from the age of 0 to 4. So these are not yet school-ready children that have. And I believe that that reflects that there has been clarification in terms of the functions between social development and education. Social development now being responsible for overseeing the provision of the service for those babies up to 4 years old, education taking from 5 years to 6 years. So, and what we have done is that each one of the departments needs to show the budget line for the ECD. So we can actually pull in aggregate to say how much this ECD is being funded. You know, but I think what this process is trying to do in making money available for the ECD access for those children, which is actually provided mainly by the communities, by the way, because what this is going to do is to increase the subsidy so that they can extend to more children in those preschools that are run by communities, but also to make sure that the some of the infrastructure is upgraded and well maintained so that they can be fully registered as complying to provide the ECD. So I think this actually is bringing a bit of clarity into the value chain of the system, and to also indicate the kind of interface that are there from ECD young babies to school going that are under education. So. The budget system, I think the budget system, obviously, when this program started, I think it's what, is it 4 years ago, it was really meant to be a high impact, quick, a process that will eradicate. So I think none of us expected that the problem would still be persisting. Because when it started, the program was under the Department of Human Settlement. And I think part of the challenge there is that there wasn't prior planning that would properly actually cost what is required, and understanding also what is required. And in fact, I think the thought was that you would actually replace these things with VIPs. But I think it became evident that in the dense areas, it actually is not healthy and efficient to actually have VIPs. So that is where now the understanding of how do you need them to eliminate. In some of the areas, you needed bulk infrastructure. In some of the areas like Free State, it became a very complicated process of actually putting the bulk. So it then needed longer planning. So that means that the costing was not properly understood. So hence the adjustments had to be made between the projects so that then as the costing is understood, then we can actually begin to align properly with what the projects are actually required. And also to ensure that those projects can be completed through the grants now. So because, in fact, I think what has happened now is that most of them have been eliminated, at least in the historically, you know, settlement, in the settlement. Where I think there's still a major problem probably is in the informal settlements, which then becomes part of the upgrading of informal settlement program that is also funded from the other grants like Urban Settlement Development Grant. And I think that grant also, there's a big emphasis to eradicate, because we're actually saying in the grant framework that 50% of that grant needs to actually eradicate informal settlement. So that process needs to be scaled up, but obviously there are a bit challenges because it's also not a very easy process to do in-suit upgrading in the process. So the cost of infrastructure, I didn't quite get that one on the Limpopo. Yeah? It's too high in Limpopo. Okay, so I suppose that is why now we have got this norm in terms of the costing of schools, at least that has been issued by the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, that actually begins to indicate that at least the cost of school should be in the average of 35, and they've indicated how that would happen. And we are hoping that that would also go some way in controlling the cost. So we didn't understand the question, suspected. So when will the review process for the district completed? That is run by the Department of Cooperative Governance. We are also all anxious to make sure that this can be completed, because that will help a lot in resolving the mechanism of allocating to this district in a more equitable and fair way, which we are struggling with now at the moment. The sharing of levies between the metros and versus the weak capacity. So I think what we need to mention here is that the levy is a replacement of the regional services levy that was eliminated a year ago. So we are doing that for the metros. We are also doing that for the districts where we are giving this special grant for the replacement. And that was meant to be a short-term measure. It is still meant to be a short-term measure, because even for the metros, that is not a very efficient revenue replacement, because of the fact that with the petrol levy, it's not going to grow in that much, because we're actually encouraging less use of, you know, transport, which can impact on how much is collected from the levy. So we are also still there looking at a more appropriate way of actually replacing that tax. So it's not there to stay forever. Okay, we have already. The learners with disability, does it not undermine inclusion? I don't actually think so, because obviously there is a policy for these children to be included, but there are also schools that are actually, you know, accommodating this. So my understanding is that this grant is actually meant to enable them to be much more, you know, to learn much more effectively by actually meeting their needs, you know, whether it's their needs for speech therapy, for therapy, whether their needs for some of the gadgets that they need, so that they can be much more effectively learn, whether they are learning in an integrated school or whether they are learning in their special schools. So I think that is the objective of this. The social grant, workers grant, its impact on the wage bill. I think what we must understand that while we are very much mindful of having to stabilize the growth in the wage bill, we are also mindful of extending services, the key social services. So what this is trying to do is there has been in the past 3 years a process of taking this the graduates through the scholarships to be trained, because there was an identified need for skills in the social work. So obviously this happened maybe before there's a major crisis now that we are facing in terms of the resource constraint on personnel. So I think what the National Department is mindful of here is that it needs to enable the provinces to absorb those skills so that they can become effective in actually supporting the service, while also really it's important also to absorb those skills because they have been trained in the process. So I don't think that would undermine our process of also still reducing the wage bill, because what the province have done, they have done very well also in terms of looking at non-core admin staff, while also they are protecting health and education, which is what we are looking for at the moment. So, Honourable Member is very doubtful whether the provinces and local government will actually bring about the efficiency and the value for money that we are looking for, given that the budgets are not growing as they are growing as they should be growing because of the restrained economic growth. So I do believe that we have actually demonstrated, I think provinces have demonstrated since 2013 and even before, that actually they can respond to the pressure for funding. Because you must remember the issue of personnel funding, which is a major issue for provinces, has been a pressure even before 2013. And the provinces had to work very hard in actually improving efficiency in their personnel management. And we have seen them also now reducing their overspending on personnel. And at the moment, they have also been reducing the numbers, particularly from the non-core, and also making sure that the excesses that were happening in education were also being addressed. So, and we have also shown that in terms of the spending on non-core, since 2013, they have reduced by more than 7.7%. And therefore, we in their budgets now, they are planning to reduce. And that is really, if it is budgeted, it is really, it is going to happen. And it is, history has shown that it's going to happen. And the work of the OCPO is also very, very important, because what they are doing also there is actually to introduce measures that will address the cost challenge of the services, but also that will also make the process to be much more transparent, so that at least you are preempting waste and corruption in a sense. And I do think that it will probably be important that if these committees can actually call the OCPO, because they have made a huge progress, and they can begin to demonstrate some of the cost savings that they have done by actually beginning to negotiate some of the prices and centralizing some of the contracts, so that then the whole of government can actually use negotiated contracts that government can use by CSIs of its spending with the suppliers. So that is actually really, it is happening, Honourable Members. Yeah, so it answers this 25 billion that we're going to achieve even more than that. The scholar transport, who is responsible? Well, I think that process, the policy decisions, I don't think it has been resolved as yet. So we are hoping that, given that there's so much pressure coming on this issue of scholar transport, that the departments that are concerned, which is education and health, will really work very hard in this current year to try to resolve this issue. We believe that greater responsibility for districts can improve service delivery, given the failure by provinces. I suppose it's an issue in terms of this functional assignment, and also how you begin to build capacity. I mean, when you look at the districts at the moment, I mean, they are struggles in many of them even to cope with what they are meant to do. So my belief is that when you have decided on assignment of functions, you need to support that in terms of building the kind of capacity and the systems that will enable that. So maybe part of the challenge is that we probably haven't done that as well as we could have done in terms of where these functions are located. But I think in the mere shift of functions does not guarantee that the function will be performed if you don't accompany that with proper mechanism to ensure that it does perform. It's really related with this issue of conversion of grants. I think where this actually has started to happen was with the realization that actually with the national department having come in and also stepped in because of the failure at the sub-national level, it became evident as also that sometimes they also struggle. So I think that is why now we are allowing this conversion, and it can happen from national to the province or local government, which has happened already. You can see it in the budget in some of the allocations that for water, some of the water infrastructure grant, some of it has already been allocated to the local. But with some municipalities, the national actually takes over from national. So even this in-year conversion, it allows the movement from national or to the sub-national or from sub-national to national, depending on where the capacity is. And I think the reason why this was introduced was with the view of ensuring that the people that are supposed to receive the service don't suffer just because the municipality or the province is not able to deliver. That is what is actually driving this, the targeting of ensuring that the service is delivered with the money that has been allocated.
With regard to the questions posed with regard to the new provincial, the three new provincial conditional grants, what would be quite useful for the committee is to actually get also more detail of where you can find more information in the Division of Revenue Bill on those issues. And if you just look at the slide presentation, slide 11 is replicated with more detail in slide 34, which I skimmed through. But if you can also look at the conditional grant frameworks for those grants, contain quite a bit of information. And if you look at the pages 1 to 5 to 1 to 7, you'll get more information on the learners with profound difficulties, learning difficulties. If you look at pages 162 and 163, you'll get more information on the ECD grant. And if you look at pages 165 to 168, you'll get more information on the substance abuse grant, which could be quite useful for the committee. Then with regard to the question posed on the performance of health, or it was, I think, more broadly service delivery, and then the role of districts. Malajing already answered it from a district municipal perspective, but you can also look at it from a different angle. Some services that's delivered, and particularly in the health sector, it's also supported by district, provincial district structures. And one of the things that's quite key there is that in the national health insurance, it's one of the issues that's also being looked at, and its role, and it then relates to a question that was also asked by one committee member. You know, the reforms to the national health insurance is critical, and we didn't mention anything. The reason why we didn't mention anything, there's already been a well-established grant in the system, and you could also get more information in the Division of Revenue Bill on that, in the text part, pages 86 and 87, and then the conditional grant frameworks. There's an overarching national health insurance grant with various subcomponents, and that's contained in pages 144 to pages 151, which could also be quite useful. Then with regard to the question on the roads and actually how is that funded, provincial roads, what we call partly funded through the provincial equitable share and partly funded through the conditional grant made available for that, because it's what we call a Schedule 4 grant, where some components of it's funded within the grant and others are funded through the provincial equitable share. Then if you look at the conditional grant in place, it's got various sub-components. One component is, and the largest component is that is for the maintenance of provincial roads. And then there's some provision for fixing the roads that were damaged by disasters. And then there's also a component to fund the Mulatto Road. But more detail on that can be found on page 89 of the Division of Revenue Bill. And the conditional grant framework is captured in pages 172 to 175. And then the last one that I would like also to provide more information on is the question by Gauteng on the provincial equitable share and the concerns raised. Remember in my presentation, I made it quite clear that it's quite important to have a correct balance between the urban challenges faced as well as the more rural challenges faced. And if you could look at slide 39, and again in my presentation I skimmed through it, but the data in the provincial equitable share formula is updated every year to actually look at, for example, the number of learners that register every year within the public school system. And if you look at slide 39, it then indicates what happens after all those data updates have happened. And one thing that, if you look then at the last full impact, Gauteng is gaining by 0.15%, and that's largely attributed to the higher or very fast population growth within a province. But I think what is also quite key to stress is that it doesn't fund all schools. It funds public schools. So the equitable share formula is geared around that. So although you look at the population growth, not all of that will be reflected in the provincial equitable share formula because some of it's not picked up by the public system but by the private school system. Thanks a lot.
We were supposed to start with the next presentation at 10:30. How much time do you still need before we cross over?
I wanted Ian to respond on the revenue enhancement question because I think that was one of the big questions that was asked on the municipalities.
And the monitoring model.
Okay, then I can talk about the monitoring model.
Yes, but if you can be short, we
okay.
Really are
so I think time with regard to the monitoring of CAPEX, with provinces, we have done a lot of work on that. We actually now, from this year, are implementing a web-based system that you can access and locate the projects, you know, and even Google the project and see whether the project is actually happening. So that system is that system that will be open that members can actually look at this project and see how they are actually being implemented and processed. So that's the system that we have been working on. With regard to the local government, the function is between us and the Department of COCTA, which has got MISA, this municipal infrastructure. So part of it was also to try to strengthen monitoring at the project level. So that is not the detail that we are picking up at our level in terms of actual project spending in this case. So I think that is where I believe that with the support that they are funded also to provide, it needs to be strengthened at that level, at the project level. Yes,
good morning, Honourable Chair. Apologies for being late. On the revenue side, Chair, we've done a number of research projects and we're about to design a large-scale program to help municipalities to aggressively deal with this revenue challenge. We have worked very closely with an institute in eThekwini called MALS, and in the Western Cape they have a revenue masterclass process. So we're part of that process and we're trying to put together a strategy that will not only deal with the revenue challenges but also the water and electricity losses. So it's a whole package. So we've concluded the research. We are also getting a number of advisors that's going to assist us to be deployed in municipalities. But this obviously we can't do on our own as a treasury. We have to do it with all our partners. And it's a long-term approach because we firmly believe that the operational stuff in municipalities, it's about best practices that has been neglected, and we're trying to reinstall and capacitate municipalities to deal with that. Chair, I understood there was also a question on municipal debt. The minister will allow us today to publish the second quarter Section 71 results. The municipal debt is standing at 117.7 billion, of which the governed, the organs of state is 5.3%, which amount to 6.3 billion. The business owes municipalities 25.2 billion. And again, we would like them to target the first big customers, the first 100 big customers. And it's about installing what we call zonal meters, because if you receive bulk, then you need to be able to track on your side and on the service provider that give you the bulk whether the numbers reconcile. So that's a big initiative. The households, unfortunately, remain still the biggest component at 66.2% or 77.9 billion. And then on the creditor side, say this is where we obviously are very concerned as a treasury, because the creditors is currently standing at 34.3 billion, and it's increased in 1 year by about 6 billion rand. And one of the biggest creditors, as you know, is the debt to Eskom. Again, that number currently stands at just below 10 billion rand. So, Chair, let me stop there. I know this is going to spark a number of other questions. And we are really trying to work close with these two task teams. That's the one that's been set up under the leadership of the Department of Public Works and National. And then there's the interministerial committee that Minister Brown is heading, and we have now met quite consistently. And I have to also indicate that we have, over the last 2 years, managed to persuade, and there is positive news in the sense of Eskom is willing to change some of their practices that municipalities has raised with us that could not sustain or help us to approve things. So there's, in this week, Eskom appeared before the Standing Committee on Public Accounts in this week on Wednesday, and they have pronounced some of these developments that was approved by the board of Eskom. So, Chair, we are very optimistic that we're gradually going to make progress, because if both parties don't want to compromise, then we're not going to help the system. Thanks.
Indeed, we need more time, you know. So I think we will then have to discuss on what we do in future. All right? So I'm not going to allow for further questions. But then I'm going to advise members. Remember, we've got this other avenue that we can use to ask questions. It's written questions to the minister, but also oral questions to the minister to respond to the house. So please, for those remaining questions, can you use those avenues? I think that's still our work, but then using these other avenues. Okay, and then before I close,
No question, just a clarity, Chair. On that latest information that was, can we get that in writing, some hard copy of that?
In writing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe I can take advantage of this. Sir, on revenue collection, there is desperation for increase of revenue collection, particularly at local government level. Then you say to enhance it. That's what you said. It is a long-term project. We can't. No, we can't. Find an innovation. We need it desperately. We need the revenue desperately. Innovation of making, of maybe you should submit to the committee your short-term, medium-term, and long-term strategy on enhancement of revenue collection. But not only at local government level, even at a provincial level, because one of your, in your presentation, there must be an improvement in terms of financial management. There must be an improvement in revenue collection, even at provincial level. So if you can submit to the committee that plan, we will appreciate. Thank you very much. I'm not out of disrespect, but actually must also respect my ruling now. I'm going to hand over to my colleague who will now chair this session that is following on the presentation by Financial and Fiscal Commission. Welcome to the Financial and Fiscal Commission delegation. Over to you, sir. Thank you so much. You were such a good audience for me.
Okay, we advise that with a continuation, members, that we give opportunity to FFC so that, thanks very much, co-chair. Members will, in an organized fashion, can serve themselves tea there and come back, continue in an organized manner that is not disruptive, so that it's just seamless continuation of our meeting. Prof, welcome Professor Plakis, together with the team, Finance Fiscal Commission. Of course, we know, members, we have had, since the minister tabled the budget, we have had engagements on the fiscal framework, which was the first stage that were what was concluded, and now dealing with the division of revenue, I think we'll appreciate the input of the FFC, which plays a very critical role in shaping the budget process in our country. So can I give to you, Prof, so that you can start. This acting CEO. Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Plakis.
Chair, I think you were right, Mrs. Good morning to Honourable Chair and the members. Just for the record, that I'm the current acting chairperson of the Finance and Fiscal Commission, and I've brought with me the acting CEO, which is Mr. Velile Mbete. And I've got my research director, which is Dr. Mabugu. And then I've got the other researchers, research managers, Sasa Peters, Khalid Dawood, Eddie Rahabe, and Dr. Nkulu Ngube, and our secretary, Ansuya Daura. Chairperson, very quickly, our presentation would look broadly at the background, economic outlook, and the 2017 division of revenue, our general comments on the 2017 division of revenue, changes and additions to the financial fiscal framework, and particular reflecting on national provinces and local government, changes and additions to the conditional grant. The conditional grant story is quite an interesting part of shifts within the governmental transfer system. We look at government responses to the commission, but also our recommendation on the SCOA. Just to confirm that, I'll ask Dr. Ramos later just to help the committee with, because we did make a presentation submission this year which spoke to the whole question of rural development, and in there we're starting to craft a particular understanding of what rural development is in our 2017 submission. So we'll help in terms of giving you a sense of the characterization of rural and rural development. Notwithstanding the 2017 Division of Revenue bill is crafted in conditions of exceptionally difficult domestic and global economic conditions. We see that there's a continuation of the fiscal conditions, rather fiscal consolidation, given our sluggish growth forecast of 1.3%, which is kept in the same way as what we had last year. There is ongoing protection of spending on the social wage, and in particular, making sure that the budget is pro-poor, on health spending and health social grants and basic education. And there's a reasonable increase, probably nominal, in terms of social grants that we know has an impact in terms of helping with levels of poverty alleviation. We are of the view that that public finance and fiscal measures are insufficient, and that we need to look at a rather faster growth of inclusive economic growth that will allow for jobs, but also have an impact on stubborn poverty and inequality and unemployment. So because of these low targets in terms of growth, because of its inadequateness to address issues of what we normally call the triple challenges, we see that the 2017 division of revenue continues to look at social and fiscal risk, which remain high, and this requires prudent financial management and allocative efficiencies. The budget is also underlined by government continuing to exercise fiscal restraint and improve the composition and quality of spending to minimize long-term fiscal risk. And our submission, therefore, is in terms of Section 2141 of the Constitution and Section 35 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Act. So just to confirm what we said in a meeting that we had with the chair, Eunice Karim, and the other chairs, is that we have the view that the budget is consistent with the economic development trend that we're finding ourselves, and in particular, consolidation of fiscal practices. I would like now to hand over to our research director, with your permission, Chair, to take us forward. And I would like to say also that given the speciality across the budget, it will be different at different points, different people presenting who are daily working on the various aspects of the Division of Revenue, Honourable Member. Okay.
Welcome.
Thanks, honorable members. I'm just going to give a brief presentation about the economic environment underlying the 2017 Division of Revenue. We may have shared this slide presentations during our fiscal framework presentation, but again, I think it's just to give other honourable members the benefit of our assessment of the economic outlook underlying our submission. In general, Chairperson and honourable members, I think what we are noting is that there's a glimmer of hope ahead. The declining trend of economic growth seem to have run its course, and the economic prospects are boosted by the changing global economic landscape. We're seeing a strong recovery of the U.S. economy. We're also seeing the rebound in major economies of Western Europe, which is spilling into EU. But again, what we also need to mention there is that the growth, however, remains below the needed targets to address the triple social challenges that the acting commissioner has mentioned. I mean, in the figure above, I think the red shaded line actually indicate the gap, the growth gap between what the NDP target says and where we are. We are currently are. So it actually indicates that we're still very far away from reaching the targets required to reduce poverty and unemployment. Well, despite the optimism, Chairperson and honourable members, there's still some vulnerabilities within the external space, and we need to acknowledge some of the downward risks. And some of those relate to the policy direction of the new U.S. administration, especially increased protection pressures, which also have implications for some of our industries. We have seen developments in the poultry industries, which is a result of some of those changes in the U.S. There's also uncertainty around outcomes of negotiations over the Brexit and the sentiments against global integration and political dynamics in some of the key U.S. states. And also there's an issue around the sustainability of Chinese stimulus, given the vulnerabilities of the state-owned enterprises and also the nascent credit bubble in that economy. Domestically, Chairperson, what we are noticing here is that there's a slowing investment and rising unemployment. And this the figures there, what they actually show is that the growth in fixed capital commission is actually tracking unemployment, and there's a worrisome trend of weakened investment growth working in tandem with low employment and employment levels. And these weaknesses are actually more pronounced in the private sector. The growth in investment in the private sector in 2006 compared to 2015 is over 2 to 24%. So, if actually we can actually see that the private sector growth investment have slowed down very rapidly, and the net effect of such of those changes within the labour market is an increase in the number of unemployed people by over 500,000 people, 587,000 to be precise. There are also sectoral dynamics which are impacting on the household. The sharp contraction in the agricultural sector, although there's a rebound expected on the back of good rainfall, we still have some regional problems, especially within the Western Cape, but on other provinces we're seeing recovering agriculture output. There's a mixed fortunes again in the mining and manufacturing sector, which account for about one-fifth of the economy. So if there are problems in those sectors, the economy will take very long to recover. The sluggish growth and weak labor markets have adversely affected the wage growth and household consumption expenditure. Between 2008 and the current period, household growth has gone down by over 2%, and these weaknesses are exacerbated by low levels of investor confidence and pressures on disposable income from high levels of indebtedness. Chairperson, we also did some assessment on the overview and the general assessment of the 2016 Division of Revenue Bill, particularly relating to the technical changes on some of the clauses. In particular, what we note there is that the Commission have raised concern about the growing trend of indirect conditional grants, and what we welcome for this particular financial year is that the national government have responded to some of the recommendations that we've made in relation to this, with the clauses that regulate conversions of allocations between in revising indirect conditional grants from direct conditional grants. However, there are still some concerns that we still think that needs to be addressed, particularly relating to the thresholds on conditions under which direct grants are converted into direct grants. Because this may lead to partiality in certain instances when the thresholds are not very clear. We also caution about the long-term unintended consequences on the use of indirect grants, especially on the repairs and maintenance, because when there's this constant addition on new infrastructure without paying attention by the national government, without providing additional funding for maintenance and infrastructure, this may create long-term problems on maintenance in the future. So, but what we are essentially recommending is that national departments should be encouraged to strengthen their oversight and monitoring roles, monitoring mechanism, instead of just relying on indirect grants when there are issues of underperformance at municipal level and also provincial level. Chairperson, there was also some technical changes which were made in the Division of Revenue, particularly relating to the delegation of authority when the national departments are submitting reports to the National Treasury. This has created a number of accountability problems, and now there are provisions which are made in the bill to ensure that when those delegations, there's a proper processes which is followed to ensure that there is proper consultation. So in general, the Commission welcomes the changes as is of the view that they will prevent inconsistencies and accountability problems that could arise as a result of delegations and assignment of powers. Lastly, Chairperson, the bill also makes provision for underpayments made to municipalities to be corrected within 10 days after it comes to the attention of the National Department for responsible for local government. And I think this is also a welcome development from the Commission perspective, because delays in payment disbursement of grants to municipalities can disrupt service delivery if municipalities have to wait for the correction to be made on a quarterly basis. So we think that this BD arrangement of addressing those inconsistencies is a welcome development. Chairperson, with your permission, I would like to hand over to my colleague Sasha to take you through the major changes in addition to the Division of Revenue.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee and other colleagues. I'll take you through the next couple of slides which relate to the major changes and additions to the 2017 DOR and the Commission's view on them. So the next slide shows the real year-on-year changes in the Division of Revenue amongst the three spheres. There are a number of aspects that the Commission welcomes in the 2017 Division of Revenue. First is the prioritization of allocations to the local government sphere. Despite the tight economic conditions we find ourselves in, we see that allocations to municipalities grow faster than allocations to the other two spheres. Particularly notable is the positive real growth in the PES and LES, and given that the equitable share allocations fund the delivery of constitutionally mandated basic services, these real increases are welcomed and, if effectively spent, can fund the delivery of an expanded basket of basic services. But what we recommend here is that national government carefully monitor and support provinces, and that national government and provinces do the same with respect to local government, so as to ensure better planning and overall greater efficient and effective spending and implementation of service delivery programs. Then the Commission also welcomes plans over the 2017 MTF to reduce indirect grants, especially because we see these grants, as my colleague mentioned, as carrying the risk of weakened accountability and poor maintenance budgeting. And the Commission is of the view that these types of grants should only be used as a last resort. In terms of higher education, the Commission is cognizant of the growing pressure that the sector places on the fiscus. And in this regard, we welcome the introduction of the pilot project for a mixed funding scheme to cover for the missing middle income group. The Commission is, however, of the view that as part of the feasibility assessment of this funding model, government should determine the long-term financial implications of this approach, as it may have significant consequences for the fiscus. The FSC did make a submission to the Fees Commission on the 2nd of March, where we detailed in full our view on funding higher education, and that is available. In terms of infrastructure investments, we know that infrastructure has been identified as a key binding constraint to economic growth. So the Commission welcomes the sustained spending on infrastructure, which amounts to 950 billion rand over the next 3 years. However, the Commission cautions that, that budget allocations alone cannot drive economic growth, and that this needs to go hand in hand with proper planning and execution. In this regard, we welcome the new infrastructure budgeting facility being introduced to address these kinds of challenges, specifically in large infrastructure projects, and we look forward to finding out more about this facility, particularly how it will relate to existing efforts such as the President's Infrastructure Coordinating Committee and the 18 strategic infrastructure projects that have already been identified. Just in terms of the provincial fiscal framework, we note that unlike in previous years, there have been no baseline adjustments in allocations to the provinces, and in addition to injecting some stability around planning, the Commission notes that by keeping the baseline unchanged, government may be signaling that further reductions could have an adverse impact on service delivery, especially on health and education. I've touched on this, but whilst acknowledging that real increases in allocations to the PES and provincial conditional grants are insufficient to cover the significant backlogs that exist within the education and health sectors, these increases should enable a marginal, at least a marginal expansion in the delivery of basic services. I think the important point here is that the Commission welcomes government's announcement of a review of the PES, and we look forward to being briefed on what the milestones with respect to this review process are. In terms of the local government fiscal framework, as mentioned previously, we note the relative prioritization of allocations to municipalities, especially the additional resources to the LES, which serve to offset the increasing costs of basic services. However, the Commission is of the view that municipalities can only be realistically compensated for the rising costs of basic services if the true cost of municipal operating and maintenance services are used to inform the LES allocation. And to this end, the FFC and SALGA have developed a model that accounts for different cost-influencing factors. Chair, if I may hand over to my colleague to look at conditional grants. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair, and all honourable members. I'm going to look at the additions to conditional grants in the 2017 Division of Revenue. First, we look at provincial conditional grants, the changes there. We see that the provincial conditional grants are going to grow by a rate of 8% despite some continued downward revisions, as we are going to see there are a number of downward revisions. Total conditional allocations for 2017 will amount to 96 billion from a projected baseline of 100 billion. And we see that these allocations are increasing, but at a decreasing rate due to the effect of consolidation, which we have mentioned before. And the grants which are revised downwards are shown in that particular graph there. And mainly we see that the human settlements development grants, in terms of value, it is revised downwards more than the rest. And the comprehensive HIV, AIDS, and TB grants, as well as the mass science and technology and the health facilities revitalization grant. We see as the Commission that these reductions may undermine development outcomes, especially since they hit some of the essential services. But we welcome on the next slide the new provincial conditional grants. We welcome some of the new provincial grants, especially the early childhood development grants. Members will recall that in 2016-17 in our submission, we recommended that there should be such a grant to afford. There should be a grant on early childhood grant, and we are happy that this grant is there, and also the learners with intellectual disabilities are also catered for, which is in line with our recommendations. The Commission supports the introduction of the new social worker employment grant, which is allocated about 600 million over the MTF period. However, there is a caution there from the Commission that we would like to encourage government to avoid designing scholarship programs which are linked to any form of guaranteed employment, as this could result in financial mismanagement, especially if a department did not budget to absorb new graduates as part of its particular budget. Then on the NHI conditional grants and the implementations of the reforms, the Commission notes the closure of the direct NHI grant, and we realized that this particular grant had some challenges, especially poor spending, which was as a result of poor capacity or as a result of poor supply chain management processes. But welcome that. Then we also welcome the subsequent upward adjustment of the indirect NHI grant, which is to fast track implementation. We think that the indirect grant should be used to address capacity and governance challenges experienced during the NHI pilots. The Commission also notes the plans to introduce the NHI fund in 2017-18. Such plans need to be underpinned by speedily finalization of the NHI white paper, which will inform the proper design of the fund and the sequencing of the reforms thereof. Looking at the changes to the local government conditional grants, we see that many local government conditional grants will see their baseline reduced, which is shown in that particular table below. But there are some reduction amounting to 2.8 million, billion, sorry, and some increase which amounts to 4.3 billion. So the net effect is actually an increase. We need to point that one out. But looking at these particular grants, the ones which are affected mainly, the municipal infrastructure grant, the MIG, the water services infrastructure grant, the urban settlement and public transport, these are the grants which actually affect most of the basic services of infrastructure, water, human settlement and transport services. That's probably our concern as the Commission. The Commission is also concerned that cuts to baseline disproportionately affect direct grants, linking it to our recommendations in the previous years that some of these direct grants are underperforming compared to the some of these indirect grants are underperforming compared to the direct grants. So we would have expected the cuts to disproportionately fall on indirect grants. With respect to the water services infrastructure grant in particular, the Commission is further concerned that this grant is affected more than any other grant, despite the scope of this grant being increased to include sanitation. Then lastly, I'll look at some measures to improve the performance of the local government sector. The Commission welcomes the realization, as it was discussed in the morning, the realization that there are some disparities in the funding of district municipalities. A number of district municipalities have been receiving very low allocations from the RIC levy replacement grant, a development which has actually affected the service delivery by these districts. So the idea of supporting some of the of these districts is welcome, especially the 13 district municipalities which are receiving the low allocations from the RISC levy. But the Commission would like to see a long-term sustainable model for funding of districts. This should be taken as a temporary measure, interim measure, to relieve the pressures which these districts are facing. So a long-term measure will be welcome. We know that this long-term measure must be informed by a proper identification of the functions, the powers and functions of districts. And we are also eagerly waiting for that to be finalized by COCTA. The Commission also welcomes the four government focus areas to improve the performance of municipalities, especially the Municipal Standard Charter of Accounts, which will improve the flow of information and which will enhance the financial management of municipalities, the supply chain management improvements which were mentioned, which will minimize irregular expenditure or outright corruption, the proposed guidelines to set tariffs, especially on electricity. This will actually minimize disparities in cost of services, and also lastly, the issue of or the focus on improving asset management and asset maintenance. This will actually enhance the performance of infrastructure. With that, my colleague will end this.
So, Chairperson, that we table our recommendations on the division of revenue in May, and those recommendations we tabled comprise like 37 of it. We had 9 chapters. My apologies, there were responses, but there were 11 chapters of which responses were made in terms of 9 of the chapters. One of the chapters there were no responses, it was probably the one on public entities. But be that as it may, there's a general agreement with government, by government, on the recommendations that we have tabled. So there is a high level of synergy, and I think it's probably got to do with a result of the domestic and international economic conditions we find ourselves in, because there's not lots of space for maneuverability. When it comes to this committee, we broadly agree with the recommendations that you've made. On the outreach program, on the use of reporting systems, the only thing that we would say, there's a need to look at how departments are able to do this, but also to look at how this can be absorbed in a broader educational outreach. On the role of out of basic social infrastructure to the poor, as a commission, we agree with that, but I think there's a need to build in-house capacity to enable basic social infrastructure rollout through our years of submission to this commission. We've raised many a times the central need of human capacity development, which obviously has knock-on effects for the human development index of the country. It's got knock-on effects for the economy, but also how do we manage the state and state resources. So we think that's an ongoing conversation that needs to be held with this forum. On the measures of to reduce lease cost, we're fully in agreement with this committee, but we think there's a need to look at the costing and pricing of ownership versus the leasing of office accommodation. See, on the rest of it, the colleagues has mentioned our responses to the division of revenue, but also responses to you and how we see the equitable share and our comments on that. We have the view that improvement in economic growth prospects as a means of generating additional tax revenue to bring down the budget deficit and public debt should continuously be a prerequisite going forward over the MTF period. Chairperson, that in a nutshell concludes our presentation to you, and hopefully we've managed to catch up with time for you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Prof. And the FFC team members. That's a very pointed submission by the FFC. I welcome any comments. Premise, of course, on the very topical matter on the global economic environment. I see the chair of the Free State Finance Committee, Honorable Ima. Okay. Okay, please don't be hesitant, members. You're welcome to engage the FFC. Okay, I have noted, members. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Now, from the Free State side, I just want to bring it to the attention of this House that we have conducted a research through the University of the Free State on the impact of the equitable share on rural municipalities in the Gariep district in the Free State, which is one of the most poorest districts in South Africa. And I think the outcome of that research would be very interesting to FFC, because it's and to National Treasury, because it contradicts some of the issues that they always tell us as technocrats. And we want to take this research further. And I was thinking, Chairperson, through you, that we should ask the Free State University and our team that did the research to also come and brief this Select Committee on Finance and also National Treasury and also FFC, because we see it as an independent research and not with any bias to anything. We want to know exactly what is the impact on the poorest of the poor. So the proposal that I want to make is that we should find in your program space for us, for the University of the Free State and the team that did that research to also come and do that presentation and try and influence, because you will see there is certain issues that are very interesting that everybody is avoiding to talk about and just putting it under the carpet. So I just want to put that proposal to the Select Committee. Thank you.
Don't you want to highlight those things that we say are put under the cover?
Chairperson, I've raised it how many times on different levels. And some of the issues is the cost cannot be the same in Gariep Dam as it is in Gauteng. This is one of the issues. And the impact of the formula itself on those areas of rural. But it's fully explained in the research paper.
Okay, thanks, member. I think the point that you're raising, will welcome the research paper as committees, and of course we'll circulate it to members. Honorable Imam.
Thank you, Chair. I'm glad that FFC agrees with us in terms of the challenges with the grants and also the issue of the allocations to districts, which should actually increase, and I think maybe their responsibilities also should. However, one of my concerns is, you know, we're talking about radical economic transformation in the country at the moment, and here you've highlighted that the household growth has declined by 2%. Now, clearly for me, that is the divide is getting bigger by the day. The inequality is getting greater all the time. So I don't know, on the one hand, we're going to be talking about economic transformation, but here you can see clearly what is happening in terms of to the people on the ground, the poorest of the poor. I'm a little bit concerned about those social grants, because in my understanding, in a presentation that we had not long ago, here we talk about social grants are increasing, but at the same time, I know when we had a presentation, we found that they had either underspent, and the reason for that was people were dropping out of the system and whatever it is. So I don't know. For me, it's a little bit conflict. I must agree on the issue of the maintenance. It's a serious problem throughout the country. I think we have that problem. You can see loud and clear with the water infrastructure throughout the country. And there's no emphasis on actually ensuring that people spend that money, even if they're budgeting for it now. And yes, I think what we need to do is maybe we need to get some guidelines on how do we ensure. I know that we've discovered something in this committee, that strategic plans are not well thought when people come for these budgets. They just prepare it, they plan it to get the resources, and then they plan after that. And that is the problem. So I think, yes, I agree that we need to put some emphasis on ensuring that the money allocated for maintenance in every aspect must be spent accordingly and not diverted for other purposes. Now, my concern is, I think my colleagues are gone. You know, they were sent here to check what we are saying about the United States. Now, we're talking about the, just a joke here, about the protectionist of their economy. Now, the question is, why would we not do the same here? I think you all are aware the number of jobs you are losing just in the poultry industry. Leave everywhere else. If you watched yesterday's media in terms of the textile industry, in terms of the leather industry, why are we not doing that? What do you believe we should do differently to address that on a more serious note so that we can, you know, try and protect our people and put South African and South Africans first before everybody else? Chair, for me, I think that what FFC is basically giving us and the information that they're giving us is very, very important to assist us even in terms of our oversight, to such an extent that, you know, it's even the PBO. The PBO gives us a lot of information. FFC gives us a lot of information that we are here. But I find there's a problem in terms of the departments coming together in terms of Treasury, PBO, and FFC and things like that, because each individual entity is picking up and identifying challenges, but they're not coming in a common platform to be able to sit and address that. And for me, that is where we seem to be having a little bit of a problem. So if I think we can rather have more of a common approach and where they can sit down, and that's why I feel that all of them must be here together when they do presentations so that they can all participate and we can then push it here and there and find out what is the way forward. I'll stop for the chair.
Thanks, Dr. Fick. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you to the FFC. They always give us valuable information that we could use. It's just a pity that every time, or rather most of the times they come with an acting chairperson and an acting CEO, and that seems to change quite frequently, but nevertheless. But we do. But one thing I can say, they do send quality presenters, so we appreciate that. Chair, just the three issues here. Slide number three. We talk about budget continues to be pro-poor, yeah, and that's, we support that 100%. The only, and then in the same slide, the same sentence, they talk about the increasing of social grants. Now, that's, for me, I understand at this point in time it's not easy for another solution, but perhaps we should rather try and look at job creation, you know, which is more permanent and sustainable instead of grants, you know, and we need to seriously see if we can come up with a long-term solution. I understand it's difficult in the current environment, but we together need to look at ways of trying to ensure that, yeah, my colleague, Honorable Sheikh Imam, talks about industries like poultry and textile, and maybe we must really put more emphasis on trying to invest or encourage investment in those sorts of job-creating industries. Then, this one doesn't have a slide, but on page number 5, I'm not too sure what the slide is. I see there's the second bullet, not sub-bullet, in other words, the sluggish growth and weak labor market has adversely affected wage growth. Now, I'm just wanting to understand that, because in my view, we could put that in a more positive way, because surely that's one of the cost-saving measures to stifle and to retard wage growth at this point in time, because our understanding is that the wage bill is high as it is. So maybe an attempt should be made to try and stifle and try to slow down the growth, yes, but by doing that, it's actually not adversely affecting the wage growth, it's positively affecting the economy, and maybe that's the way of looking at it, I understand. But, yeah. And then page number 9, Honorable Chair, which is my last point here. Now, again, yeah, you know, it's always good to comment when you get information that you can use. And again, we have a major problem which we need to resolve here. So this is appreciated, the fact that the real growth in your provincial equitable share on and conditional grants is still insufficient to address the backlogs, but in education and health. Now, you know, that's something, there's no compromise for that. Some solution needs to be made. Because, I mean, if there's an uneducated country, then you're going to have problems. If somebody is unhealthy and you don't have a solution for resolving that in order to provide health facilities, then people are going to die of diseases that is not necessarily terminal and so forth. So we need to look at a solution, because in my view this is a serious problem, and we I'm just, my point is that we need to look at how we can resolve that. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Member Shope Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was also worried about the acting status of the FFC, and we were not told why a professor is acting. That is one. Two, I think I welcome the research by the Free State. You said Free State University. I'm suggesting that we actually have the copy sent to us so that we read it, but also invite them to present in the presence of Treasury and the FFC. Lastly, Chair, I'm worried that I don't see Treasury. They disappeared. Okay. No, I'm happy. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you done, Honourable? Okay. Just to, I think, to indicate, well, Professor Plakis has been with the FFC as a commissioner quite a long time that we have had been with him. So we were notified, I think, as chairpersons, about the appointment of Professor Plakis as an acting chair. I must apologize earlier. I may have confused you because I said acting chair and I was advised otherwise. So I think, members, earlier you did raise issues which I think still they've been raised now, that earlier we did make a remark really to the extent that the sequencing of our strategic priorities should be designed in a manner that appreciate that there's a decline in revenue collection and the challenges that we are faced with. We made that point very clearly, and I think it's a point that we have to, on our own, the committee need to look into whether what is allocated, the allocations are consistent with the priorities and the ranking of those priorities. I think that's our issue, because it borders on the on our responsibility as a legislative arm of the state, whether or not our oversight, are we doing exactly what the money bills empowers us to do? We may have to really look into some of the issues. Are we not really operating within the limit? We should be stretching ourselves, I think, to the full capacity, particularly given the current economic climate. These are matters that we should be addressing quite vigorously as members of the committee, because we need to attend the issue of under expenditure, the conditional grants, very well pointed by the FFC, that these grants, the decline over time, may impact on service delivery. Treasury did allude to that issue, but of course says, but there's a perennial problem of under expenditure in other instances. So these are the issues that we have to attend to, so that they don't lose sight of our activities. So I'll give FFC to make comments. I know we had very useful discussions, the FFC tabled, when we discussed the fiscal framework discussion.
in part we have debates and discussions about the fiscal framework, the division of revenue. It will be very important to look into those matters of the provincial and national spheres, because the grants are twofold: to address national priorities as well as provincial own priorities, the significance of the grants. So we really need to look into the impact that we are making in that regard. Thanks. Any Honorable Shal, you want to have the last?
Hey, now, relating to what you've just said, the matter of fiscal consolidation, what will that effect be on health and education, referring to baselines, referring to future budgets, listening to Honorable Van Rooyen from the Free State? I'm very interested because my province is a bit bigger than the Free State, with lesser people, but point is distances. How is this fiscal consolidation going to affect those budgets, specific in rural provinces? Yes. You see, at the end of the day, we are sitting here as politicians, must go and explain that to the people in our constituencies. And then I don't have the National Treasury next to me or the FFC. I'm standing there alone. And that's the point.
Thank you, Prof. Can respond. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to share it with the staff of the FS, the full-time staff. Just to get something out of the way, the reason why we acting is fairly simple. We're waiting on the Minister of Finance and the President to sort out the confirm the appointment of the Chair and the Deputy Chairperson. So that's why you need to have somebody acting between different... We're in an interregnum of the functioning of the FSC. So that's the reason. The other reason why we're having an acting CEO is that the last CEO's term has ended. There was no renewing of the term. So that's why we're acting. So that's in a sense of prudency and regulatory functioning, that's the way it works. So we are waiting for the confirmation of who's going to be the chair and deputy chair. Just to respond to the Honorable Van Rooyen, you will probably see that in the submission that we've made, Chair, last year, May, on rural development and intergovernmental fiscal transfers for the Division of Revenue, there are a number of issues that your researchers have spoken to our staff about that's captured in that report. So it will be quite useful to see from a provincial perspective, because there's a huge focus on what is rural development, interventions that needs to be made, the issue of distance, the issue of costing and pricing of services, the issue of infrastructure, all of that, and physical and social infrastructure, meaning the education, health and welfare, parts of it, is addressed within that particular report. So it will be quite useful to see where the story is different. And my hunch is the story is not going to be different. It's just probably the elements of emphasis. So substantively, there won't be much difference. Probably the element of emphasis. On the strategic plans and stuff, I think what is going to be critical to the other honorable member, I'm sorry, I don't have a list of all the names in front of me, is that it is incumbent on you to be able to make sure, because the reason I think why, almost at comrade, the reason why Chairperson Mohai raised the issues, I've been around for time, is that it is incumbent on this forum, because we have such with those difficulties when we get called by different portfolio committees to come and give a response on a health budget or education budget or sectorial budget, that it's incumbent on this forum, because we can't be saying it, that strategic plans and annual performance plans need to be costed and priced. And just to plump the budget on it is not going to work, because then you don't know, you cannot monitor what you cannot see. So you need to be able to, in fact, the whole of Parliament need to be able to get to grips with too. So if you say you want to do this, what is going to be the costing and pricing of it? So if you're going to put 20 million rand to a particular project, then you need to ask, what can 20 million buy in a pool of more than 55 million people? Probably nothing, probably just salary and administration. So those are the type of questions that you need to ask. In fact, the PFMA gives you the power, gives you the obligation on the particular department or entity to, in terms of Section 35, that it must be costed and priced. So there is a new responsibility which links with the element of fiscal consolidation, because the fiscal consolidation, it might be a huge thing to financial and economics persons, but it's the consolidation is about, there's not much growth in the budgets, there's not much growth in the tax space. This is the amount of funds that we have in the envelope. We need to consolidate our spending. We need to cut where the wastage are. We need to be able to look at where we can actually maximize inputs and outputs and see the returns of it. That's essentially the story of consolidation in the element of concern. So the question that you're asking, what does it mean? It probably means reprioritization. There are certain activities that happens in different provinces across the country, which probably is not this, probably no returns for the citizens that you're dealing with, for the citizens that expect the services. There's a need to, at the provincial level and also at the national level, to look at where's the wastage, where the efficiency gains. And the efficiency gains is about value for money. It is about can you get more out of 100 rand than spending it on other wastage, elements of wastage. So we think that's critical. But the other aspect that I wanted to raise before I hand over to Dr. Mabungu is that there is a need to investigate why, because underspending, overspending has been a perennial problem over the years. I think we need to get to grips with what does that mean? Because we sit at a distance. And Honorable Van der Rooy, our research is relatively independent and autonomous. We do engage with the Treasury and stuff and look at various points. But there is probably this thing that we have to relook at how team finance operates from provinces to national when it comes to some of these things. Chair, with that, can I ask to hand over to Dr. Ramos.
thank you, Chair and honorable members. Let me try to pick on some of the questions that are still outstanding. Honorable, you raised the issue of why don't we have more protection here in South Africa, given that the U.S. is indicating that may be the direction. I think for South Africa, protectionism will essentially be an on-call that we score against ourselves. And the reason is pretty easy. We are, by world standards, a small open economy. We depend quite a lot on exporting so as to generate revenues. And perhaps in the modern history, South Africa actually has experiences to share with the rest of the world on why protectionism tends to be self-defeating. Essentially, the whole apartheid project was about protectionism, and we know that after some time, it runs its course and becomes quite costly to maintain and to implement. So it's most likely that protectionism route for South Africa, even at the broad strategic level, will be scoring that phone call. But importantly, in terms of the issues of redistribution that we are talking about, when you do protection, you actually are favoring industries which are inward oriented and not externally oriented. So the one industry that you will continue to work against that you're trying to build in this present time is your agriculture will be disincentivized by more protection. Tourism will be disincentivized by more protectionism. Mining will actually disincentivized by more protection. So on the broader aspects of it, and when you look at which industries are likely to be the future growth drivers for South Africa, it's pretty much those industries that a protection strategy will hit a lot more for South Africa than your intention. So essentially, the smaller you are by world standards and the more open you are, the less it makes sense to go for a protectionism. And I would even argue that for a big country like the United States, in the literature, there are essentially no good economic arguments for protectionism. It resonates quite well from a populistic point of view that you pretend that your own citizens come first, but when you do the finer grain analysis, it's some of your people that come first, and the other ones you don't put onto the surface, particularly farmers or people quite dependent on your external market that get hit from protectionism. Then around coordination with the National Treasury, PPO, I think our coordination, some of the things that we don't say here, coordination with National Treasury, we do quite a lot of behind the scenes coordination, guarding each institution's independence, of course, but we do a lot of discussions and finding each other's position around an issue before we come to the House. And a lot of it is legislated as well as driven in terms of how we consult constitutionally. But I think with the Parliamentary Budget Office, there are administrative aspects that we may want to strengthen in line with your recommendations, so that when we come to brief this particular committee, we've had that prior discussion with them, and we come and brief you so that when you take the briefings from the three independent institutions, you have the full picture around whatever it is that you'll be dealing with. Now, coming to the questions from Dr. Fick, the first one, the issue around social grants and job creation. I would say, first of all, we face development is essentially two things. That's the simplest way of understanding development. Then we can talk rural development or urban development. But development is essentially about the growth component and how that growth is redistributed. So those are the two components. So social grants work on the redistribution part of the development definition. And that leaves what we do with the growth or the job creation, as you have said about it. And I do agree, job creation should be much more emphasized than it currently is. But from our research around social grants, it turns out that social grants also have a developmental aspect to them, that A lot of that money is not purely consumption. A lot of it is spent on education, school uniforms, as well as nutrition for the children that go to school. On the balance of probabilities, because it's probabilistic estimations that we do, on the balance of probabilities, there is a large developmental chunk in the social class. So it's not, as it were, purely a consumption. So that may address some of your concerns around what are we doing with the job creation. With social grants, here you have a tool that also addresses maybe not as satisfactorily as we want, but it's not purely a consumption. At least it has inbuilt those developmental aspects to it. Then around the wage growth, and I think we fully agree with the sentiment. But from our previous recommendations, and this is one of the recommendations that is in the pipeline, is where we're actually calling for an alignment between the wages and productivity growth in the public sector so that you get full value for the proportionately higher wages that you're paying in the public sector. So we've proposed a definition on how to implement productivity and are now waiting for a government to operationalize that definition, because they've said in principle they agree with the recommendation. But what was lacking 2-3 years ago when we made the recommendation was how to operationalize that. Yes, so now the final aspect, which was when we came, you were discussing the definition of rural development. And just to say, in our submission for this year's Division of Revenue, its focus was rural development and intergovernmental fiscal relations. And one of the recommendations that is not responded to in terms of the documentation that you have, because we've agreed that it's not directly related to the Division of Revenue, was when we called for a government-wide definition of rural development. And what has been done in that process is that recommendation has been referred to a Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, who we identify as the coordinating department that should then call a Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Statistics South Africa, and a host of other social players to set up a working group so that by the end of a given period, they come up with what we use as a rural development. It's no use saying rural development is one of the top five priorities. Essentially, if you haven't defined something, chances are you are ill-funding it. And that's why eventually it will become an issue for Standing and Select Committee on Appropriations, because if you don't define it, how do you know you're adequately funding it? And we have our proposals, suggestions on the elements of rural development and what are the tools that should be on the table, both to reclassify as well as to do ex-ante analysis of finding exactly what monies or funds go into the rural areas. But we will do that once the recommendation is accepted by government to undergo the process that we're talking about. Then the suggestion by Honorable Van Rien, we are luckily quite fortunate in that his committee called us to sit through one of the presentations when this study was being workshopped with the free state, and We will welcome formally responding to the study as Financial and Fiscal Commission, and also to add in that as Financial and Fiscal Commission, in collaboration with SALGA, we have just finished a study on costing municipal basic services. So we have that study, it's been launched, and what just remains now is tabling it with Parliament. And that study goes quite a long way in approaches to costing basic services. And part of it reached the recommendations that government has responded to by saying it accepts in principle the approach to costing, the proposed new costing of basic services, taking into account special factors, socioeconomic factors, etc. And what now remains is to go into the actual details of how it influences the equitable shares. Thank you.
Do you want to do the parting shot, Prof?
That was the parting shot.
Okay, that's a good one. Okay, then I'm going to make concluding comments and give co-chair to make the comments. But before that, I think she wants to do it. Yeah, it would close now. Let me allow the co-chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is follow up. How long is it going to take government to approve the definition on rural development? Because the problem is now, also in terms of your recommendation to National Treasury, this year's budget is pro poor. That includes rural development. So how long? Because this year we're supposed to be implementing because there's a budget that is pro poor. And if by now that definition has not been adopted, what does it mean? Because there's budget for rural development.
Prof, yes.
I, Honourable Chair, I don't think we can help you with that. I think it's incumbent on Parliament and the political parties that deals with this particular matter, because, and also the executive. What we can suggest to you is that whenever you interact with the departments or the ministers, you keep the 2027 submission, the 2016 submission next to you that we've given, and then you every time refer them to what we've recommended, because many a times what we recommend seems to be gathering dust in a range of places. So I would say part of that is to keep that and use it as the Bible till we get to the next budget, that submission we gave you in 2016. And in there, you continuously draw people back to that definition until, you know, the Pavlov thing, conditioning, 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 until people start understanding that there is a particular way that we, because we also see the rural definition as like a continuity, that it connects with the urban metropole, and there are lots of characterizations in it. So I would suggest if you can keep that next to you, use that as your standard of measure for when people interact with you on a range of matters, it will probably help instilling the importance of the rural focus. And if you don't have the submission, we can ask Henry, Henry Eckstein, to bring more copies to both committees of our rural development submission.
Follow up? Sorry.
No, Chair, I can, you know, you're raising a very important matter that they will not respond to. They admitted. But government has had a working definition of rural development that is used. We use the terminology rural and poor municipalities. We know you refer to especially populated, underdeveloped, all of those factors that define rural development. So we will, but I think the issue that the FFC raised from their presentation, which is very important, is qualitatively. Now, as a government that want to infuse the discipline of action, what are we saying when we say rural development by definition, and what resources then follow in terms of addressing that we characterize as rural development? Currently there is, even when we look into our literature, when we say rural, in fact even the buyers, Treasury attempts to use some of the formulas to say this formula is biased toward responding to rural conditions. This formula must mitigate between urban and rural. So I think it's a matter that policy questions that the committee will quickly have to deal with. But I think it's incumbent on our committee, because we have to more often interact very closely with the committee that has obligation to report also to, when resources are allocated, what is the outcome, what is the impact of the resources, the monitoring and evaluation department of government, which our appropriation committee, I think, has to find that dynamic link to relate to monitoring and evaluation, because it's not just about allocation of resources, what impact the resources have yielded. So I think we will have to deal with these issues. We'll have to deal with the issues that are raised. But because this is not the last engagement with the FFC, particularly in the light that the first engagement was on macro framework. Chair, you'll recall not so long ago when we met 2 weeks down the line, these discussions is a heated discussion. And I think that's why my earlier remarks to say that there are some of the issues that points directly to the committee inwardly that the committee has to look into and highlight specific questions for further discussions, I think, with the FFC and other relevant stakeholders, with Treasury and other relevant stakeholders. So we will have to find more time on our side so as to sharpen our tools, even to engage on oversight work with the rest of government. Now, having made this indication that this is the second stage now pointing on the division of revenue, but it's not, it's part of the, it's comprehensive. You can't make a technical divide between fiscal framework and the division of revenue, because it's premised on what is it that the country is capable of producing, what revenue, what are the sources, where would we get this budget from. Now, this meeting, I think, will enrich the further process of the division of revenue. There is a process, I think, that will unfold of the NCOP, especially after the Standing Committee and the National Assembly have approved the division of revenue. It will be referred to the National Council of Provinces, and it will facilitate very useful discussions around the issue of negotiating and final mandates. That's why chairs and members of the committees of finance are here, very keen. And we normally fight about the time frames, but now this is very much open, and so we'll coordinate much more in a constructive spirit. So this information will be helpful in that regard. And then the committee will then engage, will still have opportunity to deal with National Treasury, FFC, SALGA. In that context, we'll want SALGA as well to make his presentation. I think SALGA was supposed to come, but SALGA to make his presentation, because it's very important sphere of government to make his contribution. So thanks, members. The issue around economic inclusivity, what plans South Africa has. Maybe we must not use this term of exclusive. Yeah, exclusive. Yeah, it's not helpful. I think I agree with you, Dr. Ramos. Characterize it very well. But sovereign plan, what is it that is unique that defines South Africa's agenda in terms of growth and development? And what is it? Because you can't just argue that efficiencies and then economy will grow. But what is it? What is it that something that will ensure that we break ranks with the past structure of economy? I think that's a very important issue that we'll have to, from time to time, deal with. So thanks very much, members. We are on time. Unless you want more discussions, I can give you the last 20 minutes. But thanks very much for your attendance. And Co-Chair, can you... Thank you very much for your contribution, Co-Chair. And the last word is yours.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm actually covered by my co-chair. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have really had fruitful and robust engagement. Thank you.
Thank you.